You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
It's an embarrassment and a shameful performance by the mainstream media, and reflects the fact that the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, where it began infiltrating the media in the 1950s, has been successful, where William Colby, then its head, was even in the position to testify to Congress in 1975 that the CIA owned everyone of any significance in the media. And today, Bonnie, it's only become much worse.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show, March for Our Lives, What You Need to Know. Jim Fetzer is McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth and author and researcher. A former Marine Corps officer, Jim Fetzer has published widely on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution and mentality. The founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, his latest books include The Evolution of Intelligence, The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, Render Unto Darwin, and The Place of Probability in Science. Today we discuss the broad ramifications and underpinnings of the political movement March for Our Lives, attributes and analyses of false flag events in general, and events in Parkland, Florida in particular, and political attacks on the First and Second Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Dr. James Fetzer, welcome.
Oh, Bonnie, it's a delight to be back with you again. So much has been going on. Unbelievable.
Yes. Well, we've had what is being described as the Valentine's Day Massacre at a high school in Parkland, Florida. How do you approach the study of these events to figure out what's going on?
Well, because of my philosophical background, Bonnie, I probably do this slightly more systematically than others, looking, for example, for different kinds of impossibilities that tell us that what we're being told can't be true, one of which are the logical impossibilities. You know, without having to inspect an object, that it can't be both a round and square, because the mathematical properties are different. To be a circle or round or a sphere has all the points equidistant to a center. Square has angles and sides that don't have those properties. Sometimes it's said, of an honest politician is a contradiction in terms. We know that's not strictly speaking correct, but it makes the point. We know of persons that they can't be in two places at the same time. So that just by knowing, for example, as sane progressive has observed, where this woman is quite brilliant and has done excellent critiques of Las Vegas and now Parkland, she points out that numerous news stories from Fox and Daily Beast have reported that Nicholas Cruz, the purported shooter, pulled the fire drill at 2:30 to draw students out. But the official timeline shows Nicholas Cruz left the building by 2:21 before the fire drill went off. Now, they can't both be true. So, you know, something is wrong with the narrative right off the bat. We have other examples, for example, from Las Vegas, where Intel Hub has discerned that while Stephen Paddock had earlobes that smoothly attached to his head, that the body in the photograph from the suite at the Mandalay Bay has curled earlobes and therefore cannot be the same person. Similarly, the body subjected to an autopsy was measured at 73 inches or 6'1", whereas we have a hunting and fishing license from Alaska that shows Paddock to be 6'4". Now, a particularly stunning case when it comes to Parkland is that we know David Hogg, who has been a central figure and spokesman for the movement, did a video with students during the shooting, even reporting at 3:13 the identity of the shooter, which wouldn't be made formally for another 30 minutes. But interestingly, he's now done an interview with CBS in the aftermath of the March for Our Lives, in which he explained, and I'm quoting him here, "On the day of the shooting, I got my camera and got on my bike and rode as fast as I could 3 miles from my house to the school to get as much video and to get as many interviews as I could, because I knew this," and it actually says could not be another mass shooting, but he surely meant could be another mass shooting. What's fascinating about this, Bonnie, of course, is that it blows the whole story of where he was and what he was doing right out of the water. And this is even just based upon preliminary considerations of the impossibility of one person being two places at the same time. I also look for physical impossibilities, violations of the laws of physics, chemistry, biology, physiology. For example, in the Boston bombing, we had these explosions. Because I'm a former artillery officer in the Marine Corps, it occurred to me that these were not powerful explosions. I've described them as puff pieces. I've sometimes suggested that I don't think anyone could have been killed by them unless they were perhaps actually sitting on top of them. And yet when we peer through the smoke, we see bodies lying there that are missing arms and legs. Now, that sounds horrifying until you notice that there is no blood. Now, it is a physiological impossibility, as Lorraine Day, who MD, who is the head of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital, has observed, to have arms and legs blown off by explosives and for there to be no blood. But the fact is that the blood only shows up later, and it's fake blood. It comes out of tubes. It's too bright red. Real blood turns dark because it loses its oxygen. The difference between arterial and venal blood, for example, Bonnie. And we know where it came from because there are these little orange duffel bags where there were 5 or 6 scattered around the area after it was cleared that are actually little blood kits. A striking case from 9/11 is the approach of the plane that's supposed to have hit the Pentagon, barely skimming the ground at over 500 miles an hour. Now, when I take this up with pilots and aeronautical engineers, it turns out that's not even an aerodynamically possible trajectory because of the effect of what is known as downdraft or ground effect. That plane could not at that speed have got closer than 60 or even 80 feet to the ground, which is higher than the Pentagon at 71 feet is tall, which may explain why we have a complete dearth of evidence, debris from a plane having hit the Pentagon. You got the clear, clean Pentagon lawn, no debris whatsoever. It only starts showing up later. And even as far as I have been able to sort out, appears to have been dropped by a C-130 that was circling the building. So in cases like this, we're given significant tells, signs right in the evidence that what we're being told can't possibly be true. A third category are technical or technological impossibilities where the technical conditions for conducting an event or an action are unavailable at the time. This is particularly telling in relation to the moon landings, which occurring in 1969, 1970 or so, we are told, because it turns out that we didn't have the propulsion power to escape low Earth orbit, that we didn't have the computing power to navigate to the moon and back. Indeed, the computer diagram by NASA as having managed all this isn't even a functional computer. In other words, it's a complete joke and deception. We, in addition, didn't have the capability of negotiating the Van Allen radiation belt, which would have led to the demise of the astronauts. In fact, it's fascinating, Bonnie, that NASA recently acknowledged that the major obstacle to manned missions to Mars is the Van Allen radiation belt, as though that had only shown up since 1969-70. It's been here as long as Earth, approximately, 4.5 billion years ago. So if we can't navigate it now, we certainly couldn't have navigated it then. Indeed, it's fascinating with regard to moon technology. It's one of the, perhaps the only field in which we haven't made scientific progress since its innovation, where in fact we've even had the absurdity of spokesmen saying that we lost it or destroyed the technology to go to the moon, which is a real crock. Indeed, I'm fascinated, Bonnie, by NASA having recently offered $20,000 for assistance if the public can help with its space poop problem, that they have space diapers that'll hold excrement for up to 14 hours. But these trips to the moon, Bonnie, took 7 or 8 days, which tells us that the whole story about moon landings is nothing but a giant pile of space poop.
Jim, while logging into my email on Saturday, I noticed that Yahoo was live streaming the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. I clicked on the live stream and watched this very scripted and staged event. It had clearly been well organized down to the last detail, featuring young people, students, and of course the ubiquitous David Hogg and Emma Gonzalez demanding new gun control laws and attacking the NRA. One of the big messages of this concert and demonstration was to get people registered to vote and to vote against those who support the NRA, to, quote, vote them out. That was emphasized. The whole thing didn't strike me as something high school kids would be doing. This was a well-orchestrated political event. Did you see any of this? And what did you make of it?
Oh, absolutely, Bonnie, and you put your finger right on it. This actually was a voter registration drive. It was a DNC campaign event in relation to the primaries, the next round of elections, where, for example, in Florida, there are 11 congressional seats that are up for grabs. Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Democrats desperately needed to change the narrative before these midterm elections. They'd suffered a string of embarrassments and defeats politically from scandals such as the collapse of the Russia hacking allegations against the Trump administration, where it turned out that the high-ranking officials of the FBI, James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, and others, were in collusion with this Christopher Steele fellow from the UK and fabricating the dossier, which even appears to have been paid for by the DNC and the Hillary campaign. It turns out that as a couple of investigative journalists who followed the Clinton campaign reported in their book Shattered, published in early 2017, the Russian hacking meme was actually made up by John Podesta and Robbie Mook within 24 hours of Hillary's concession speech to distract attention from the incompetent campaign they had run, from the contents of the WikiLeaks revelations, which lead directly to Pizzagate, where John Podesta himself is pedophile-in-chief, or so he appears. We even have a video with his voice in the ping pong pizza, very, very strange stuff. And, of course, to obfuscate Hillary's own entanglements with Russia, where she, as Secretary of State, was involved in the transfer of 20% of U.S. uranium reserves to Russia in return for a $145 million contribution to the Clinton Foundation, by way of the Canadian company Uranium One, which required the approval of then-President Barack Obama. But, Bonnie, if Julius and Ethel Rosenberg received the electric chair for sharing atomic secrets with the then-Soviet Union, what do Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama deserve for selling off 20% of U.S. uranium. The fact is that the House investigation has concluded there was no evidence of any collusion, and the scandal has been a profound embarrassment. We even have the Imran Awan trial looming, so that where they, of course, were the Pakistani IT guys who worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz in the House of Representatives, where she allowed them to spy on other members of the Congress. Now, there's a scandal worth contemplating, but to distract attention when the Anwan trial is in the works, they needed to change the narrative. It turns out that as much as the students have been praised, G. Edward Griffin has observed in his piece, "Guess Who Organized the Parkland Student Anti-Gun Activist?" Hint, it wasn't the students. It turns out that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was not only lobbying the Florida State Legislature, the Teachers Union was providing buses, Michael Bloomberg and Women's March groups were organizing the March for Our Lives, MoveOn.org, promoting the project on social media. Because, as you're implying, Bonnie, these require a great deal of anticipation, planning. My goodness, we even have like 100 different variations of T-shirts for the Parkland event. Now, that in and of itself would have required a great deal of planning, manufacture, deciding on the patterns, the whole bit. But it was done much, much too soon, which suggests to me, and I would say that, you know, this falls in the category of being technically impossible to produce all these events in such a short period of time without prior knowledge, that this was all a very elaborately staged production. And of course, we have a mountain of evidence that everything that took place at Parkland fell into the same category, as we can pursue in considerable detail.
I'm speaking with author and researcher Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show, March for Our Lives, What You Need to Know. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Regarding the funding for this March for Our Lives, you've mentioned several organizations. I've also read about something called Every Town for Gun Safety, Giffords, something called Avaz, and I think you mentioned the Women's March LA. I've read that the real goals of this march was to raise funds and register voters for the Democratic Party. Actor George Clooney was in attendance and donated $500,000 to it.
That's right, and Oprah as well, I gather. But I think you make an impeccable point, particularly considering that Congress had just adjourned. So they weren't actually in the position to go to congressional offices in the House or the Senate. This appears to have been a completely, very thoroughly planned, extensively funded event as a public relations effort for the Democratic National Party, which has long regarded gun control as one of its prime issues since the Sandy Hook event, where, just to mention in passing another example of physical impossibility, Wolfgang Halbig, who has done so much work in this area, has recently produced a photograph of 8 of the Sandy Hook girls looking real perky and cute and on, you know, much, much older, juxtaposed with their photographs as decedents at Sandy Hook, where we have discovered that they fabricated the children at Sandy Hook by using photographs of older kids when they were younger, which, of course, explains why the medical examiner, Wayne Carver, wouldn't allow the parents into the school to view their children, why there was no surge of EMTs, why no string of ambulance to rush their little bodies off to hospitals where they could be pronounced dead or alive. They were all fictions, and it's just stunning how, when you dig deeper into these events, you find the American people are being played again and again and again. Bonnie, we even have the FEMA manual for a 2-day event at Sandy Hook, where they had a rehearsal on the 13th going live on the 14th, which explains why there were porta potties already in place, pizza, bottled water at the firehouse. Many had name tags on lanyards. There was even a portable sign that said everyone must check in. Parents bringing children to the scene. No parent would bring their child to the scene of a child shooting massacre. It even says in the manual, everyone must check in, which explains the sign. And of course, restrooms and refreshments are a standard part of FEMA drills where the players are identified by color-coded name tags on lanyards. All the pieces fit, Bonnie, but it's been it's completely different than what we have been told by the mainstream media, promoted by the government. But this appears to have been a Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Eric Holder, Daniel Malloy, Connecticut State Police, Newtown School Board, fake parents faking having kids where they have been paid off handsomely, Bonnie. The school board got a grant of $50 million for a new school where the old one had been abandoned by 2008 because it was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards damaged by hurricanes. There was even a major flood in 2007. It was uninhabitable and appears to have already been condemned, where the parties, the alleged grieving families, 26 in number, split between $27 and $130 million in donations from sympathetic but gullible Americans, meaning they pocketed more than $1 million apiece. That's pretty good for playing the role of a crisis actor. And now we have these Parkland kids, many of whom were unaware that this was a staged event, who are receiving immense amounts of publicity, and where we also have reports that George Soros was busing in participants for the March for Our Lives. None of this is as it has been presented to the American people during what will now, I have no doubt, become endless hours of media coverage, just as we have been exposed to over a year of repetitious ongoing coverage of the non-existent Russian collusion by the Trump administration. It's an embarrassment and a shameful performance by the mainstream media, and reflects the fact that the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, where it began infiltrating the media in the 1950s, has been successful, where William Colby, then its head, was even in the position to testify to Congress in 1975 that the CIA owned everyone of any significance in the media. And today, Bonnie, it's only become much worse.
Well, with regard to the March for Our Lives, this turned out to be a global coordinated protest with demonstrations in foreign countries calling for gun control in the United States. Why would foreigners be demonstrating for this? As well, I read an article entitled Parkland Students Rally in Israel and Dubai to Demand Gun Control in America.
Oh, Bonnie, that's just great because, you know, you had a couple of sisters from Parkland in Israel talking about how safe they felt in Israel, that they felt more safe in Israel than they did in what is supposed to be one of the safest schools in America in Broward County, blissfully unaware that Israel is an armed camp, that you have, you know, even young girls carrying AR-15 assault weapons in the streets of Tel Aviv. I mean, it's just stunning their ignorance here. In fact, it turns out that there's been a steady diminution in gun violence and gun crime in the United States over the past years. Let me give you figures, for example. Gun violence since the 1990s. In 1993, a death by firearm per 100,000 people of all ages stood at 15.3. By 2014, it had dropped to 10.5. That's a 30% drop. Homicides from 7.0 per 100,000 to 3.4 by 2014. Non-fatal violent firearm crime victimization has dropped even more dramatically, from 726.3 in 1993 to 174 a 0.8 in 2014. That's like a 75% decline. It also turns out that worldwide, gun ownership and homicides are inversely related, so that the regions that have the highest gun ownership have the lowest homicide rates. For example, while North America, the United States, and Canada have among the highest gun ownership, they also have among the lowest homicide rates. Other regions such as Latin America, South America, Brazil have among the lowest gun ownership, but among the highest homicide rates. Africa, again, among the lowest gun ownership, highest homicide rates. So we find that, in fact, there's an inverse relationship. Which would you prefer? High gun ownership and low homicide rates, or low gun ownership and high homicide rates? Those appear to be the choices. Indeed, Bonnie, it is shocking to me that Americans are a lot looking to Chicago, which has among the most stringent gun control laws in the country, but also among the greatest rates of gun violence and homicide perhaps in the world today. It turns out, by the way, that there are 5 million AR-15s in the United States, but only 5 have been purported to have been used in mass shootings. And those would include in Sandy Hook in Las Vegas and now in Parkland, where those were all staged events. We can demonstrate, and in fact it appears, and this is one of the most interesting aspects of Parkland, that they used what's called simulated ammunition, where you have bullets that are made out of beeswax and laundry detergent, which turns out to explain why we had the miraculous recovery of a number of students who claimed to have been shot but couldn't possibly have recovered in the brief amount of time since the event had they been hit with high-velocity AR-15 bullets, including Maddie Wilford, shot 3 times in Parkland, who's so grateful to be here, including, according to the physician, in the stomach and in the chest with an AR-15, which I guarantee you would be fatal wounds, and yet she's able to walk out with nary a scratch. The doctor says young people heal miraculously fast. This is another example of physical impossibilities in this entire story. We have Samantha Fuentes, who is supposed to have been shot in both legs with an AR-15, and yet she's a week later able to walk and be interviewed by a reporter and cover her wounds with Band-Aids, Bonnie. I mean, this is simply absurd. Even the New York Times published a piece about the massive damage inflicted by AR-15 wounds, which means, of course, that neither of these girls was shot with an AR-15, but rather supports the thesis that it was done using this simunition, this simulated ammunition, where the teacher who claimed to have confronted a police officer dressed all in metal garb with a bulletproof vest and a helmet and so forth said she couldn't recognize the rifle he was using, where I have another expert who suggested to me she didn't recognize it because it was a sim gun, a specially designed weapon to fire these bullets. Another example is the girl who said she was in Holocaust class, who deflected a bullet with a book. She said it was a tiny book, which is preposterous if it had been an actual AR-15 high-velocity slug, but makes sense if it was one of these bullets made out of beeswax and laundry detergent. I mean, the fakery here and the medical anomalies are simply overwhelming.
I'm speaking with author and researcher Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show, March for Our Lives, What You Need to Know. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What have you learned about the sheriff of Broward County, Scott Israel?
Well, this is a very interesting case, Bonnie, because Scott Israel turns out to be the first Jewish sheriff of Broward County. He actually campaigned as a Talmudic Jew, which for those who understand are going to be rather stunned, because the Talmud may be the most racist document ever conceived by the mind of man, espousing Jewish superiority over other humans, referred to collectively as the Goyim, where the Jews are as superior to the Goyim, who only exist to serve the Jews, according to the Talmud, as human beings in general are to the other animals, such as cattle, where the Jews are entitled to lie, cheat, steal, abuse, even kill the Goyim with impunity. I am not suggesting that this is a widely held Jewish belief. It's simply that when he campaigned, he was actually signing the Talmud. And just as this particular branch of Judaism is objectionable, we find parallels in the Muslim world where the Wahhabism of the Saudi Arabians is on an equal par, where they believe in slaughtering infidels and taking their women and turning them into sex slaves. And of course, I don't need to enumerate the atrocities that have been committed by various groups in the name of Christ. So here we have a stunning example of the sheriff, where he appears to have been coordinating the event, deeply involved. The fact that he was invited by Senator Chuck Grassley to address the Senate committee in investigating gun violence and school safety speaks volumes, and has to reflect the fact that he's embarrassed he'll be asked questions about his deputies not entering the school. Whereas Tucker Carlson asked when he interviewed him on his show, he appears to have ordered them not to enter the school in apprehension that he might mistake some of the players for real shooters and take them out, which would be, you know, a horrific end to a very carefully stage-managed event.
How did a political movement, March for Our Lives, grow out of what is described as the Valentine's Day Massacre at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida? And we're not talking about Al Capone. Incidentally, the New York Times ran an article about how the original St. Valentine's Day Massacre changed gun laws.
Well, of course, that was the machine gunning of one gang by another. I mean, using Tommy guns. I mean, it was quite a vicious event. We've seen it portrayed in numerous movies. How they could draw a comparison is indicative of why they chose Valentine's Day for this event. They wanted it to play on the memories and recollections. They wanted to change the subject. Because, you know, since Obama first took office, there's been a steady stream of mass shootings right to this very day where behind-the-scene perpetrators are applying a Chinese water torture to American consciousness, which entails, you know, this constant drip-drip of these events where the globalists appear to believe it's only a matter of when a critical mass of citizens will rise out and demand the outlawing and subsequent confiscation of guns. As Mike Adams, who has been ranked as high as number two most influential on the internet, who was hit massively after he interviewed me, where his entire channel, including over 1,700 videos, was taken down, as observed, and as Dave Hodges of the Common Sense Show has emphasized, the Hawaiian Demography Project revealed that there were 19 genocides during the 20th century, which were preceded by gun confiscation, and totaled the murder of over 263 million people. We are wise to preserve the Second Amendment to defend ourselves, not only from intruders to our homes, where we know that the average time for a police response is as much as 20 minutes, when the mayhem tends to take place in the first five or six. So while you're waiting for the police to arrive with their weapons to defend you, it may be that your daughter has been raped, your wife has been murdered, you've been mugged in the meanwhile. But most especially, as Judge Napolitano has observed, assault weapons aren't protected by the Second Amendment for the purpose of shooting deer. They're protected by the Second Amendment for the purpose of shooting tyrants. We had to fight our first American Revolution to emancipate ourselves from the rule of Britain, and we may hopefully not have to fight a second in order to preserve the integrity of the nation from modern-day tyrants, of whom these who are involved in perpetrating this hoax at Parkland as those at Las Vegas, as those at the Boston bombing, as those at Sandy Hook before us, are all perpetrating frauds on the American people, including theft by deception, in order to instill fear into the public, in order to make us more amenable to manipulation to promote their political agenda, which is clearly inimical to the best interests and general welfare of the American people, Bonnie. It's a tragic situation that you should have one party seeking to capitalize on what, if they were real, would be real tragedies, but where, in fact, they've been fabricated again and again and again. I have not only done interviews and presented videos laying out the evidence about it, but have published books bringing together experts on different aspects of these cases. For example, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook had 13 contributors, including 6 current or retired PhD professors and other experts, including Paul Preston, who is himself a school administrator, who was so bothered by what he saw being broadcast from Newtown that day that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, each of whom confirmed to him that it had been a drill, that no one had died, and that it was done to promote gun control. But I have others about the Boston bombing, about JFK, about 9/11, about Orlando and Dallas, about Charlottesville, each of which has 13 to 15 contributors. And I'm in the process of editing yet another volume on Las Vegas. And now, of course, alas, we'll be obligated to bring together the best students of Parkland as well, so that there will exist somewhere in the world a documented account of what actually happened during these events, which we're obviously not getting from the mainstream media, and where Google and YouTube and Twitter and Facebook are doing their best to obliterate all of the research being done by citizen journalists who are picking up the responsibility heretofore carried out by the Fourth Estate, which has been completely infiltrated and subverted, prostituted by the CIA and other agencies of the United States, but where the overarching theme appears to be one of promoting the interests of Israel, where we have 100 of the officials with CNN, for example, who are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens, and where Cynthia McKinney revealed a few years back that when new members of Congress arrive in Washington, they're asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States, where those who resist find themselves confronted with a well-financed alternative candidate, or even that their district has been redrawn and that they no longer have a seat. Cynthia was able to prevail over those obstacles, but others, such as Dennis Kucinich, have not been. We have to understand that the resistance, there has been interference in our election, but it hasn't come from Russia. That interference instead has come from our gallant ally in the Middle East, Israel, which is seeking to utilize the resources of the United States to benefit itself, regardless of the consequences and costs to the United States and its citizens.
Well said, Jim. What about the coroner of Broward County? Do we know who this person is?
Well, it's rather fascinating, Bonnie, that you raise the question, because they had to get the right coroner in place in order to make sure all this would work out right. And it turns out that the previous coroner appears to have been framed, that $500 was put in the sock of a patient he was dissecting during an autopsy. He discovered the money, put it in an envelope, was going to properly dispatch it, return it to its rightful owner, but it disappeared, and he was framed for theft, of which he appears to have been completely innocent, so they could bring in a new coroner whose greatest distinction appears to have been to identify the body of Saddam Hussein which is completely ironic, Bonnie, because Saddam Hussein was actually taken out in a B-1 bomber strike on April 7th, 2003. I know the mother of the pilot, Chris Wachter, who conducted the operation, dropped 400 or 500-pound JDAM bombs on a restaurant in Baghdad, took out Saddam, his two sons, and 50 or 60 members of the general staff. He was lionized, put on CNN, given the Distinguished Flying Cross, eventually befeted at the Crystal Cathedral of the Reverend Robert Schiller in Orange County, California, whose services are broadcast on television, apparently alerting the Pentagon that he was being recognized for this event, because officially Saddam had been, you know, found in a spider hole. They took one of his doubles, made the apprehension, put him on trial, and hanged him. But in fact, I have an expose in the book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, which includes two chapters about the first death of Saddam Hussein. They had Captain Wachter return to Langley and informed him, while they admired his flying skills, that officially Saddam got away, even though we have Dick Cheney quoted in the New York Times, no less, as stating that, yes, he thinks they got Saddam, that his battered body was dragged out of the rubble and he wasn't breathing as a consequence of this B-1 bomber attack. In fact, Australian photojournalist Joe Viles had noticed that they differed in their teeth and their bite, that the Saddam had excellent teeth and a regal overbite, meaning his upper teeth extended beyond his lower, but his replacement had bad teeth and an underbite, which was the tell. I actually obtained the Ace of Spades from a 52 card pack for the American command in Iraq and confirmed that Joe Viles was exactly right, that Saddam had been killed in the earlier bomber strike, and the man who was put on trial and hanged was, in fact, one of his doubles. It's a fascinating story, but once again, the American people are being bamboozled for the sake of promoting a political agenda.
I'm speaking with author and researcher Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show, March for Our Lives, What You Need to Know. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And also with regard to the Parkland shooting, the Secret Service was reportedly at the school providing active shooter training 3 weeks earlier. Is this regularly done?
Well, the story appears to be the following, that the Secret Service came in a couple of weeks before the event and changed their security protocols, which is rather stunning. It's never been done to anyone's knowledge in any other instance. The security policies for the Broward School were actually designed by Wolfgang Halbig, who's not only a retired Florida state trooper, but and U.S. Customs agent and school administrator, but a nationally recognized school safety consultant who, in fact, first became interested in Sandy Hook because he wanted to learn what had happened there so he could advise other school systems on what to do to avoid it. Not only did the Secret Service oddly come in and change the security protocols, which not only was reported by students, but by a teacher to Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, but they took down a security camera on a freshman building. It turns out that the cameras were on a delayed basis, 26 or 27 minutes, which makes their footage all but useless for a real-time response. There were a host of other oddities where students who survived the Parkland shooting were reporting they were told the police would do a fake code red with fake guns, that it was going to be done. An active scooter drill would be done this week. Students thought they were participating in a drill. Another reported the Army people told the kids not to look around at the bodies they moved and hid under mats, no doubt because they weren't real. The only actual footage we have, and they appear to have shut down the students by directing them not to use their cell phones, which have cameras, with over 3,000 students, you should have cell phone footage all over the place, but it doesn't appear to exist. Live Leaks released a 58-second footage from inside a classroom, and you can see students who are screaming and crying. One girl is talking about her bottled water as though that would be an urgent issue under the circumstance. Another is using her iPod. You can see a body lying there in a pool of blood, but it appears to be fake blood, just as we had in Boston. And the body appears to be a mannequin with no arms and no head. I mean, it's this bad, Bonnie, the extent to which they're going to deceive the public here to promote the Democratic political agenda. Frankly, it's embarrassing because we're able to expose what actually happened, but actually shameful that a party should be exploiting the emotions of the American people by fabricating traumatic events of this kind. It's in fact a form of faux terrorism, which of course is designed to instill fear into the public in order to make it more amenable to promote a political agenda, in this case, gun control, or at the very least, as a political campaign event in order to promote voter registration, especially among young people, where the prospects of the Democrats heretofore have been rather bleak, given the wake of scandals involving Russiagate and the DNC, FBI, DOJ collaboration and corruption, but where they are changing the narrative to, you know, focus on what they regard as a Democrat-friendly issue, gun control.
There were students telling the media that there were multiple shooters. I saw several of these videos. There was one of a young a female student who claimed she was walking out of the building talking to the accused shooter, Nicholas Cruz. They were talking to each other. She said they heard shots in the distance. They walked out together as well. Nicholas Cruz, who's I guess is going to be charged with murder, was visited 39 times by law enforcement and placed on a watch list.
This is another reason why the sheriff appears reluctant to appear before the Senate committee, which would have been his most important contribution to the public good had all of this been real and authentic. He doesn't want to have to address the issues that there were many previous reports about Nicholas Cruz. Indeed, it's fascinating that when the Donald learned that he'd been reported as many as 20 times to the FBI, but they had done nothing to follow up, he faulted them on that ground. And where David Hogg went after Trump, complaining that he was the responsible party, only subsequently acknowledging his father is with the FBI himself. And get this, Bonnie, he's not just an ordinary member of the FBI. He's actually a crisis management specialist. He's my candidate for the person who organized the entire event at Parkland and where he wanted his own son to be a key player. You're 100% correct that there's an interview with this young woman saying she walked out with Nicholas Cruz, telling him she thought it would have been him as the shooter. In the meanwhile, she's hearing sounds of gunshots in the background. We have multiple students reporting more than one shooter.
I also read that David Hogg talked about soft targets when referring to the students. And it was pointed out that the phrase soft targets, that's a military term.
Yeah, it's a military or intel term about easy targets, right? In fact, Donald Rumsfeld is reported to have said about attacking Iraq instead of Afghanistan, that he explained that Afghanistan did not have a lot of targets, but that Iraq was a target-rich environment, a lot of soft targets. That he would be using such a phrase indicates that this is someone with a bit of an unusual background. And when you consider his father being an FBI crisis management specialist, it all fits as to why he, would be the key player in this entire event, where, interestingly, Bonnie, in his very first interview about the events at Parkland, he had to pause and stop and start over five different times in order to make sure he got his words right in accordance with the script. In and of itself, it's embarrassing and revealing that this guy, in fact, is a crisis actor and not speaking sincerely about events he knows on the basis of his own direct personal experience.
Was the FBI the first to respond when the school is very close to law enforcement?
It's completely ridiculous that the FBI would be involved here. No, it ought to have been law enforcement. But, of course, as we know, the sheriff held four deputies back, which I believe we can reasonably infer was done deliberately. In this case, as in the case of Sandy Hook and Boston 2, you didn't have a surge of EMTs into the building. In fact, several EMTs complained about them not being allowed to enter the building to treat the victims. There was no string of ambulances to rush the injured off to hospitals where they could be given attention. This was true at Sandy Hook. This was true in Boston, too. Indeed, at Boston, we even had the police on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill. This is a drill." We had the Boston Globe tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. It turns out in each of these cases, the evidence is there, but you may have to dig, which is why I and my research collaborators have been doing everything we can to get to the bottom of each of these and doing our best to make that information available to the public, which the deep state in this case, in the instrumentation of YouTube, is doing its best to take down as rapidly as we can produce them, which is why we're having to resort to alternative platforms for videos where YouTube cannot take them down, such as DTube or BitChute or 153news.net. Bonnie, there's a cultural adaptation to these artificial selection procedures being imposed by the deep state, where we're doing our best to adapt. The problem being that all kinds of mischief can occur during the time this information is suppressed and not in the hands of the public. For example, no doubt they want to keep anyone from realizing what actually happened until the midterm elections, when the Democrats will derive their payoff from the investment they have made in time and resources and money to create this very elaborate public relations effort in Washington, D.C., labeled March for Our Lives, better understood March for Our Political Lives, March to Preserve 11 Democrat seats in Florida alone, for example, which Debbie Wasserman Schultz has worried were in jeopardy because of the scandals that have been exposed involving the Democratic Party, the Clinton campaign, the FBI, and the Department of Justice itself.
How would you assess the role of CNN in these events?
CNN has been an eager participant, and it's unsurprising. CNN appears to be a completely Zionist Mossad operation, where we have over 100 officials with CNN who've been identified as dual U.S. Israeli citizens. CNN, I would better describe as CIA 24/7. MSNBC appears to be CIA light with a feminist twist. But Wolf Blitzer, Anderson Cooper, and others have long been identified as representing the CIA, indeed, as have many prominent American journalists in the past, so that, you know, their reach in affecting the public has been powerful. And where it's a serious question as to whether CNN ought to be allowed to continue its exclusive broadcasts in the airports of the United States, because they are not representing a fair and balanced delivery of the news, but something that's completely biased. Just as we have now discovered that YouTube and Google are declaring that they're taking a position, a stance, Facebook too. In other words, they're making decisions about what they believe to be true or false, or really more appropriately,
which political agenda they're going to promote, which political agenda they're going to suppress. This is completely undemocratic, un-American. It's a deep state working through private corporations to conceal the gross abuse of the First Amendment that's taking place here. So we have a concurrent attack on the First and the Second Amendment, which is indispensable because if the truth gets out, then people are going to be disaffected and the agenda to take our guns will collapse and the tyranny will be stopped. The exposing these false flags can have a devastating effect on the public perception of what's been going on here, as well it should. And therefore, I'm profoundly in your debt to have the opportunity to discuss these events with you, because it's not just these school shootings, but a whole host of other events where the American people have been played, including JFK, including the 9/11. Yet a third is the U.S. Geological Survey study of dust samples on 9/11 from 35 locations that showed a host of elements present that in their quantities and correlations were indicative of a nuclear event, including barium, strontium, lithium, lanthanum, tritium, some of which only exist in radioactive form. Bonnie, we're being played again and again. The internet has become the new Gutenberg press, as Preston James has observed in his brilliant new book about to appear from moonrockbooks.com. They are so threatened, they're taking extraordinary measures to suppress it, which we can only hope will be an abject failure for the welfare and integrity of the American people and the United States of America.
Dr. James Fetzer, thank you so much.
Bonnie, it's a great pleasure being on with you. The American people have to understand the truth, and we're doing our best to bring it to them.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. James Fetzer. Today's show has been March for Our Lives, What You Need to Know. A former Marine Corps officer, Jim Fetzer has published widely on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution and mentality. McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota Duluth, he has also conducted extensive research into the assassination of JFK, the events of 9/11, and the plane crash that killed Senator Wellstone. The founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, his latest books include The Evolution of Intelligence, The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, Render Unto Darwin, and The Place of Probability in Science. Jim Fetzer's most recent articles can be found at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. That's jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. He has two JFK websites, assassinationresearch.com and assassinationscience.com. His radio show, The Raw Deal, is broadcast Tuesdays and Thursdays from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern on Revolution Radio, Studio B. He is co-editor of moonrockbooks.com and can be reached via jim@moonrockbooks.com and at jfetzer@d.umn.edu. That's jfetzer@d.umn.edu. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaramako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Kenneth Doust, and welcome to New World Notes, installment number 106, titled The Second Coming in American Imagination. The Second Coming of Christ at some future date is a key article of Christian faith. Some of us on the margins of that religion wonder why anybody seems to care. Christians believe that Jesus Christ was God incarnate. They believe that he came to earth once already, 2 millennia ago. Yet, obviously, nobody seems to be paying the slightest attention to anything he said then, during his first visit. Imagine that an anthropologist from Mars visited Earth in 2008 and spent the next year in America, living among the natives and observing their habits, customs, and rituals. Would anyone blame the extraterrestrial anthropologist if she concluded that Christianity were little more than an excuse for persecuting homosexuals, increasing military recruitment, stealing oil from Muslims, and getting together to sing 2 or 3 horribly awful songs once a week? Whether or not we believe he was God incarnate, most Americans do believe there was a real guy from Nazareth named Jesus. Americans believe that he was, at the least, a great prophet and moral exemplar. And they apparently believe that this guy's words and example have no connection with our $1 trillion War Department budget, with transferring the nation's wealth from the poor and the middle to the already obscenely rich, no connection with our refusing to heal the sick or feed the hungry, no connection with our keeping the casinos open on Sundays, with our conquering the world, no connection with our exploding and roasting alive every man, woman, and child at every wedding in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Gay marriage? Are you kidding? We're not even allowing Muslim marriage. But enough of theology. I think the Second Coming is more interesting as a metaphor or trope in the popular consciousness of our culture. In basic outline, in both popular culture and theology, the narrative goes something like this. First, there's going to be one heck of a confusing but loud big battle, the Battle of Armageddon. Helter-skelter on steroids, man. Then Christ will return and rule the world for 1,000 years of peace, progress, and prosperity. That was Eisenhower's campaign slogan in 1956, peace, progress, prosperity. Then the world ends, and that's that. As a kind of sideshow, at some point in all this, all the saved people, including the bodies of dead ones, will be swept up to heaven. The mainline Protestant church I was schlepped off to didn't make much of this oddball bit of doctrine, the rapture, but a lot of Pat Robertson types think it important. The graves will open up, and the reconstituted bodies of their occupants will ascend to heaven. Why, I can't imagine. Presumably, the souls from these corpses have been up in heaven, some for many centuries, getting along just fine without those troublesome bodies. As you may have guessed, theology doesn't come easily to me. But with or without the rapture, the Second Coming narrative has had quite a hold on the American popular imagination, particularly the return itself. The metaphor is a handy light to reveal our blindness and especially our hypocrisies, and to reveal the gap between how life should and could be, on the one hand, and the sordidness of our existence on the other. There's a classic bumper sticker that I'm going to have to censor a little for radio, but it went along the lines of, "Jesus is coming," and boy, is he ticked off. Let's hear Lenny Bruce's take on this very theme. Here's the scenario. It's somewhere around 1960. Christ and Moses return together. They visit a Reform Jewish congregation in L.A., then catch a flight to New York. It's Sunday, and they wander into the grand St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. Mass is being conducted by two princes of the church, the telegenic Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen and the old warmonger himself, Francis Cardinal Spellman.
West Coast, Christ and Moses will make Reform shuls, Reformed rabbis, so Reformed they're ashamed they're Jewish. And they got a different sound. Is it typical Reformed rabbi sound? Service, right? 12:01 Saturday night. When it should be said that the children of Israel, ha ha, Israel. Where is Israel? Is yonder Israel? Out quench on flaming Yahrzeit candle, Israel. That is the Israel of Chabeli and David and Ruth and Cheryl Ann and Joy. Oh, Rabbi, that was a beautiful speech. Thanks a lot. You like that, Vidal? Tough top, my dear. Oh, yeah. All right, now, Sunday. Christ and Moses fly to New York. Transcontinental, $88 to Chicago, $30. All right, now let's see what they would make. They'd probably make, they say, what's playing at St. Pat's? Good double bill, Spellman and Sheen. That's okay. Oh, Mr. Spellman, oh, Mr. Sheen. Okay, now, Christ and Moses both possessed humility. Why? Wisdom, that's it. Anybody who is secure, there's never any hostility, because he's cool. Yeah. Anyone who is above you, even, is, they know. So they just stand on the back of St. Patrick's, and they'd listen, look around. Cardinal Spellman would be relating love and giving and forgiveness to the people, and Christ would be confused. Because their route took them through Spanish Harlem. And they would wonder what 40 Puerto Ricans were doing living in one room. This guy had a ring on it, was worth $8,000. And he would wonder at the grandeur. See, why aren't the Puerto Ricans living here? It's clean and nice. What does it all mean? And what? And they'd just be shucking back and forth and talking. And maybe Bishop Sheen would see them back there. And run up to Spellman on the lectern. Psst, I want to talk to you for a minute. Well, you go back to the blackboard and stop bugging me now. I want to talk to you. I've got a customer in the back. All right, put the choir on for 10 minutes. What is it? What is it? You'll never guess who's here. Who's here? You're not going to believe me. You're going to think I've been drinking. All right, who's here? Christ and Moses. Are you putting me on now? I'm telling you they're here. Are you sure it's them? Well, I've just seen them in pictures, but I'm pretty sure it's them. Moses is a ringer for Charlton Heston, and I'm sure. Where are they standing? In the back. Don't look now, you idiot. They can see us. Christ and Moses, both of you. They're way in the back there. Did Christ bring the family? What's his mother's name? That's weird. I read the book today, too. I'm so nervous. Mary. Mary what? I don't know. Mary Hale? No. Mary Hale. Hail Mary? Harry Mary? No. I don't know what that was. Oh, yeah. Hail Mary. Oh, Hail Mary full of Grace Thompson. They're very thick with the DuPonts. I know. Montauk Point. They're back here. Yes. All right. That's something. If this ever gets around now, it has. Oh, Christ. Don't look in the front door. The lepers are coming. All right. Sir, would you take the bell off, please? Thank you very much. Wait, mister, will you pick up your leg, madam, your nose? Thank you. All right. They got Sophie Tucker with Moses posing. Take that Hebrew National banner down. Mr. Jess, will you get off the Madonna? That's not a stat. All right, give me a direct line to Rome, quickly. Rome. All right. Hello. John Friend in New York. Listen, a couple of kids dropped in, and, yeah, you know them. Well, I can't really talk right now. Excuse me. Hello, we're from Newsweek, and we want to know if they have State Department clearance, and is that really them? Well, I'm, yes, it is them. Sonny, get off my hand. Yes, that is them, dear, yes. I don't know if they're going to do any tricks today. I don't know. Yes, they can fly. No, Mary Martin isn't God's mother, and get the hell out of here now. Hello. You know them. One kid is, well, I'll, with a cross of bop. No, not Zorro. Damn, that's right. He brought a very attractive Jewish boy with him. Oh, we got to do something. Well, I know. I can't put him up at your place. No, I didn't paint or anything. Oh, I got a lot of kids staying over here. Look, what are we paying protection for? That's right. Just get him over here, that's all. Yeah. I don't want to hear about that. Look, all I know is that we're up to our in crutches and wheelchairs. Is that good enough for you? The place is ridiculous here. Yeah. They're in the back. Way in the back. Of course they're white. Yeah. 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 This is New York. Puerto Ricans stand in the back. That's right. I don't know. Which ones are they, Sheen? The ones that are glowing. Yeah. Dick. When I related to Puerto Rican, I dug like a funny thing of recall. Did you hear the tune up in Spanish Harlem? It's so pretty. Whew. I heard a tune. It's a rock and roll tune. For years I've been a jazz buff, you know. Now I got on a rock and roll thing, man. But is it rock? Two guys, Stola, Leap, they did like, yeah, don't talk back. You know those cats? Well, they, I assume, wrote the lyrics to Up in Spanish Harlem, and it is so pretty, man. Take something like Up in Spanish Harlem, there's a rose that's so sweet, it grows up through the concrete, man. Hits on the run, it's like a heavyweight lyric, man. Really beautiful. And I started thinking that the Puerto Ricans, they'll have their Porgy and Bess. And to all the tourists that they're going through, they'll have that culture. And you know, from decadence, beauty does come. But I started thinking, now, when the Puerto Ricans come into their own, who's next?
The song Lenny was talking about there was There Is a Rose in Spanish Harlem, recorded by Ben E. King, later also by Aretha Franklin, and, as you can hear, the Crusaders. That's the Type 1 version of the Second Coming Secular Division. Christ returns and can't believe how little attention people have paid to everything he preached during his first visit. If time allows, I'd like to read another piece along the same lines, one of the great sketches by Langston Hughes featuring the character Jess B. Semple, later if possible. If not today, soon. Let's go on to the Type 2 version of the Second Coming trope. This type stresses the commotion of Armageddon and the subsequent transformation of the world into something profoundly different, the difficult and painful birth of a new epoch. A great take on this is William Butler Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, written around 1920. It describes the West heading towards yet another world war. That was prescient of him to see this as early as 1920. In the poem, Yeats has a premonition that the horrible Armageddon that heralds in a new third epoch could be at hand. A couple of quick footnotes first. He uses the term spiritus mundi. I think the concept is from Carl Jung. It means roughly the collective unconsciousness. In the first line, Yeats uses the term gyre, G-Y-R-E. This is a three-dimensional spiral, a corkscrew, shaped like an inverted cone. It gets wider and wider as it goes up. He's talking about a warbird, a bird of prey, a falcon, circling wider and wider and higher until he is, literally, out of control. The falcon gets out of control of the falconer. And if you have a better metaphor for the reality of war, please send me an email. Later in the poem, there come references to the Sphinx, heralding the pre-Christian epoch, to the cradle of the baby Jesus, heralding the Christian epoch, And oh my God, what is coming next to herald the third epoch? Whatever it is, it's going to be a bumpy flight between airports. Here is Yeats's The Second Coming, which I will read from my marvelously preserved Norton Anthology of English Literature, which I purchased for freshman English class in 1968. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming! Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with a lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. The singer-songwriter called Sting, of the Police, knew his Yeats. We have Sting's own version of the Second Coming theme, Type 2, in his song Synchronicity 2. Here, instead of bloody warfare, Armageddon is the bloody degradation of lower middle class and working class life. And the beast that is slouching towards its own Bethlehem is an aquatic creature, the Loch Ness Monster, or maybe one of Nessie's nephews. Otherwise, it's pretty much the same poem.
Oh,
Okay, we've heard examples of two types of Second Coming tropes. Type 1, Christ returns, looks around, and boy is he miffed. Classic example, Lenny Bruce's famous routine, Christ and Moses. Type 2, all hell breaks loose, civilization crumbles, and a new epoch is born. Classic example, Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, and the Police's not-at-all-bad update of 1983. Let's return to type 1, as we do have time for Langston Hughes's sketch, Simple Praise a Prayer. The narrator, the I, is a college-educated, somewhat naive black man. His companion in the dialogue is Jesse B. Semple, nicknamed Simple. He is unschooled, lower class, and from the South. But in many ways, he is sharper than the narrator. They're both black men, both living in Harlem in the 1940s, right after World War II. So, the narrator is a straight man, and Simple gets all the good lines. Abbott and Costello. The Simple sketches were published in a black newspaper and intended for black readers. A couple of footnotes up front. Simple uses the term Jim Crow. That old term refers to apartheid, American style. Segregation, unequal civil rights, blacks in the back of the bus, whites-only water fountains, and the lot. And there's a reference to Mrs. Roosevelt. That would be Eleanor Roosevelt, widow of the late president, and a lifelong supporter of good causes, including civil rights. I'm not going to try to duplicate the sounds of black American speech, so you'll have to use your imagination. And I'm going to have to cut out a few passages here and there, strictly for time considerations. Please buy or borrow the book, The Best of Simple by Langston Hughes, and read the uncut sketches for yourself. Simple Praise a Prayer. It was a hot night. Simple was sitting on his landlady's stoop reading a newspaper by streetlight. When he saw me coming, he threw the paper down. Good evening, I said. Good evening, nothing, he answered. It's too hot to be any good evening. Besides, this paper's full of nothing but atom bombs and bad news, wars and rumors of wars, airplane crashes, murders, fightings, wife whippings, and killings from the Balkans to Brooklyn. Do you know one thing? If I was a praying man, I would pray a prayer for the world right now. What kind of prayer would you pray, friend? I would pray a don't want to have no more wars prayer, and would go like this. Lord, I would say, I would ask him, Lord, kindly please take the blood off my hands and off of my brother's hands and make us shake hands clean and not be afraid. Neither let me nor them have no knives behind our backs, Lord, nor up our sleeves, nor no bombs piled out yonder in a desert. Let's forget about bygones. Too many men's and women's are dead. The fault is mine and theirs too. So teach us all to do right. Lord, please. And to get along together with that atom bomb on this earth. Because I do not want it to fall on me, nor thee, nor anybody living. Amen. I didn't know you could pray like that, I said. It ain't much, said Simple, but that girlfriend of mine, Joyce, drugged me to church last Sunday, where the man was preaching and praying about peace, so I don't see why I shouldn't make myself up a prayer too. I figure God will listen to me as well as the next one. You certainly don't have to be a minister to pray, I said, and you have composed a good prayer. But now it's up to you to help God bring it into being, since God is created in your image. I am willing to help him, said Simple, but I do not know much what to do. The folks who run this world are going to run it into the ground in spite of all, throwing people out of work and then saying, peace, it's wonderful. Peace ain't wonderful when folks ain't got no job. Certainly a good job is essential to one's well-being, I said. It is essential to me, said Simple, if I do not want to live off of Joyce, and I do not want to live off of no woman. A woman will take advantage of you if you live off of her. You reckon Depression Days is coming back? I don't know, I said. I am not a sociologist. Use colleged, said Simple. Anyway, it looks like every time I get a little start, something happens. I was doing right well pulling down that fine defense check all during the war. Then, all of a sudden, the war had to jump up and end. If you wanted the war to continue just on your account, you are certainly looking at things from a selfish viewpoint. Selfish, said Simple. You may think I am selfish when the fact is I am just hungry if I don't have a job. It looks like in peacetime nobody works as much or gets paid as much as in a war. Is that clear? Clear, but not right, I said. Of course it's not right to be out of work and hungry, said Semple, just like it's not right to want to fight. That's why I prayed my prayer. I prayed for white folks, too, even though a lot of them don't believe in religion. If they did, they couldn't act the way they do. That is what started me to wondering. Wondering what? I asked. Wondering what all these prejudiced white folks would do if Christ did come back. I always thought Christ believed in folks treating people right. He did, I said. Well, if he did, said Simple, what will all these white folks do who believe in Jim Crow? Jesus said, love one another, didn't he? But they don't love me, do they? Some do not, I said. Jesus said, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. But they don't do that way unto me, do they? I suppose not, I said. You know not, said Semple. They Jim Crow me and lynch me any time they want to. Suppose I was to do unto them as they does unto me. Suppose I was to lynch and Jim Crow white folks. Where would I be, huh? In jail. You can bet your boots I would. But these are Christian white folks that does such things to me. At least they call themselves Christians in my home. They got more churches down south than they got up north. They read more Bibles and sing more hymns. I hope when Christ comes back, he comes back down south. My folks need him down there to tell them Ku Kluxers where to head in. But I'll bet you if Christ does come back, not only the south, but all over America, there'd be such another running and jumping and shutting and slamming of white folks' doors in his face as you never saw. And I'll bet the Southerners couldn't get inside their Jim Crow churches fast enough to lock the gates and keep Christ out. Christ said, such as ye do unto the least of these, ye do unto me. And Christ knows what these folks have been doing to old colored me all these years. Of course he knows, I said. When Christ was here on earth, he fought for the poor and the oppressed. But some people called him an agitator. They cursed him and reviled him and sent soldiers to lock him up. They killed him on a cross. At Calvary, said Simple, way back in B.C. I know the Bible, too. My Aunt Lucy read it to me. She read how he drove the money changers out of the temple, and how he changed the loaves and fishes into many and fed the poor, which made the rulers in their high places mad because they didn't want the poor to eat. Well, then, when Christ comes back this time, I hope he comes back mad his own self. I hope he drives the Jim Crowers out of their high places, every living last one of them from Washington to Texas. I hope he smites white folks down. You don't mean all white folks, do you? No, said Semple. I hope he leaves Mrs. Roosevelt alone. And I thank you for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Christ and Moses was recorded at Lenny Bruce's Carnegie Hall concert of February 4, 1961. The opinions expressed here, brilliant and obviously correct as they are, do not necessarily represent the views of this station's management or staff, let alone the licensee. For more on New World Notes, or to send feedback, or for an archive of past shows, please drop by our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Till we get to my non-carborundum, remember, not well paid, but at least blessed are the peacemakers, and please tune in again next week. Ciao.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear was originally aired in January of 2016. And here it is. On Wednesday, December 30th, I heard part of a Where We Live show on NPR. And during part of the show, the guests were talking about conspiracy theorists as if they were all nutcases. And it didn't matter the issue. Several, quote, conspiracies were discussed, 9/11 being one of them. And they referred to conspiracy theorists as, quote, horrible trolls, and said that the facts didn't matter to these horrible trolls. And Colin McEnroe, who was a guest on the show, even made the misinformed statement that the 9/11 Commission report was a complete and thorough report, which even the 9/11 commissioners themselves have said isn't the case. So according to the esteemed guests on this NPR show, the following two former FBI agents that you're about to hear would be, quote, horrible trolls, conspiracy theorists, who just won't accept the facts. The first one is a former FBI agent. He introduces himself well at the beginning of it. So let's hear his take on 9/11.
I'm Ted L. Gunderson, a 27-year veteran of the FBI who retired in March of 1979. At the time of my retirement, I was the senior special agent in charge of the FBI Los Angeles Division, with more than 700 personnel under my command and a budget of $22.5 million. I was an agent on the street for 9.5 years, and then I advanced administratively. I was a supervisor, and then I was number two man in Connecticut and Philadelphia, and assistant special agent in charge was the title. And then I became a chief inspector, and then I was agent in charge in Memphis, Dallas, and the senior special agent in charge in Los Angeles, because I had three other special agents in charge under me and 24 supervisors under them. I have information chiseled in stone, documented, that the FBI had advanced knowledge about 9/11 and did nothing to prevent this from occurring. And this is atrocious. It's unbelievable, having been a former FBI agent myself. And it's very obvious that this whole thing is being orchestrated by the powers that be at the highest level of our government. And I want the world to know about it. The minute I saw the planes fly in to the tower, on television, live, as a matter of fact, the question I had in my mind was, there is no way, absolutely no way, that somebody could skyjack four planes, 20 people skyjack four planes, in this case 19 individuals, and our government would not know about it in advance. We have, the U.S. government, the most advanced intelligence techniques of anybody in the world, and you'll never convince me we didn't have advanced knowledge about what was going on. We saw the airplanes go in, and it's also a question about whether they're remotely controlled. I don't know about that. I hate to comment on something that where I have no documentation, but there's much more to this story than has come out so far. You will never in a million years convince me that those buildings, the towers, collapsed because those planes hit them. I'm confident that they were imploded. As a matter of fact, there were seismograph readings, they think from the basement, two of them, about the time that the buildings collapsed. There were also molten steel that was in the basement, which is a very high temperature for melting steel, and those planes hit above the 80th floor, so there's no way that that airplane fuel could have dropped down that low. Also, there were fires that burned in the basement for some 100 days afterwards. So there's some implication. There's some finagling. There's some maneuvering, as far as I'm concerned, and there are many, many more people involved in this than these so-called skyjackers and terrorists. The anti-terrorism legislation was written back in the middle 1980s under the George Bush Sr. administration. A female Department of Justice attorney, who was one of the authors, made the statement publicly, before this passes Congress, people have to be killed. Now, if we fast forward to a World Trade Center car bombing in February 1993, at that time, the FBI had a 43-year-old former Egyptian army officer as an informant who was in with the terrorists. He was commissioned by the terrorists to put the bomb together. He went to his FBI superiors, we're going to use a dummy bomb, right? And they said, no, we're going to use a real bomb. So the FBI not only knew in advance that they were going to bomb the World Trade Center, they furnished the ingredients for the bomb, which is absolutely unbelievable that they get away with this. What's unbelievable about it is this was actually printed in the New York Times on October 28, 1993. But they got away with it. And if I was a congressman or senator, I would demand an investigation. Why would the FBI furnish the ingredients for the bomb that brought down or that had damaged the World Trade Center in February 1993? We had 6 people killed there. We had 1,000 people injured. We had a total of 6 citizens who died in the February 1993 World Trade Center car bombing. We had 1,000 individuals who were injured. We had $500,000 in damage. But there weren't enough people who died to pass the anti-terrorism legislation. So now we fast forward to April the 19th, 1995, Oklahoma City bombing. We had 169 people who died, probably 169 because there was one leg they never did identify. And a year later, the anti-terrorism legislation passed. Now, it wasn't tough enough. I can't prove that there were explosives that were placed in the World Trade Center in the 911 situation. However, from what I've seen, an expert on implosions from Albuquerque, New Mexico, who worked for the government as under government contract, stated immediately afterwards that the buildings were imploded. And then he retracted his statement and said, well, maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But basically, now he's saying that they weren't imploded. But other experts who have looked at the pictures say that the buildings were imploded. I think that in order to implode those buildings, there had to be implications, government implications or involvement in placing these charges. I mean, that was a tremendous project. I mean, I don't know how many people would be involved in that. Going back to Oklahoma City, an inside investigator told me there were at least 11 other people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, if you have 11 other people involved in Oklahoma City, you're going to have 3 or 4 times that involved in the World Trade Center situation.
So that was former FBI agent Ted Gunderson. To learn more about the Oklahoma City bombing that he mentioned, check out the film A Noble Lie. I think you can get it on YouTube. And yes, there's lots of evidence to support that that was also a staged event and is being covered up. But don't take my word for it. Please do your own research. I was really shocked when I first realized that the Oklahoma City bombing was not what I had been told it was by our government and media. And trust me, you're not going to hear about it on NPR. And now we're going to listen to a former FBI translator, author, journalist, and whistleblower, Sibel Edmonds, talking about who created Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Sibel Edmonds has been gagged by the U.S. government, and she's written a couple of books to get her story out. One is called Classified Woman, and the more recent one is called Gladio B, which I highly recommend. What you're about to hear is from an interview on the show Sophie and Co. on RT, with Sophie Shevardnadze doing the interview. So here it is.
The sweeping wave of the ISIS advance came out of a clear blue sky, with American drones and satellites caught napping. How was it missed by the omnipresent eye of U.S. intelligence? How far will the West now go to combat it? And is the terror onslaught too strong to contain?
Former FBI whistleblower, author Sibel Edmonds is my guest today. Sibel, it's really great to have you on our show. So when asked if the rise of ISIS was a surprise, Obama admitted the intelligence community underestimated ISIS in Syria. Did it not see it coming in Syria or Iraq?
Well, the answer depends on if you want to take President Obama or the U.S. authorities and their words and evaluate based on that. I think where the rise of ISIS is mainly about a brand change. Sometimes as it happens in marketing, we get to see exactly the same principle within the geopolitical games that have been in play for a while now, especially since the end of the Cold War. And the Al-Qaeda brand began wearing off. And that brand now has been changed to ISIS, and as always, by design. And considering the fact that we cultivated and put together and financed and created the ISIS, for me, it goes into one of those caricature or the funny statements that are put out by the mainstream media, statements issued by people like Obama or anybody from the State Department.
So what you're saying basically is it was expected for ISIS to turn into something so powerful, into a powerful group, but they're just not admitting to it.
Well, to answer the question briefly, it is ISIS is what is the U.S. media and the propaganda creators from behind the media decide to create. tomorrow or 3 months from now, we will start hearing another name that we've never heard of. And within a month, they can make that the world's greatest or the most dangerous threat. And again, that is the main concept here. And I know the mainstream media, U.S. media, the Western media, they have been playing it as such, but they did exactly the same thing with Al-Qaeda. I mean, Al-Qaeda was 100 people or 100,000 people or 10 million people. Another interesting perspective in this is that I refer to the brand change, and sometimes you have to switch the brand for the marketing purposes. And ISIS, as you can look at and see from the term, from the name now, the brand created, the Western powers have gotten closer to just name and link the entire global terrorism to Islam. And that's another marketing strategy by the United States, NATO, and the main Western countries.
What we hear from the media is that President Obama blamed the chaos of the Syrian civil war for the rise of ISIS. At the same time, you have the United States doesn't hide that it's been helping the rebels in Syria from the very beginning. Did U.S. intelligence know who they were funding?
Absolutely, as they did in the 80s with the Mujahideens in Afghanistan, as they did with various so-called Islamic terror cells within Caucasus and Central Asia, as they did with Al-Qaeda. And this is no different. As I said, you're only looking at a brand change. You're not looking at any kind of a new phenomenon as far as the U.S. global perpetual warfare is concerned.
Now, the U.S. is only ramping up support for moderate rebel groups in Syria, or so they say. So who works to determine if rebels are moderate or no? Is there really a way of knowing that?
Again, it is really difficult to talk to or talk around all these propaganda created by the Western powers through the mainstream media. And I feel like if I start even commenting on that, I'm belittling the facts on the ground. And again, I want to go back and provide the context and say, look, Mujahideens, which later became aka Al-Qaeda's, they were the freedom fighters. And we have had similar situation in the Balkans during the war. You know, you had people that were, or the factions that were considered, you know, fanatics or criminal or terrorists, whether it was KLA, and then they became freedom fighters, they became our allies. And again, you're looking exactly at the same thing, different brand, but you're looking exactly at the same phenomenon. And we can talk around this and bring in all the different characterization put forward by the Western media, and then we can put it and compare it, what has been happening in the past 30, 35 years, and we'll see that the marketing strategy is the same, it's just the brand difference.
What we're seeing right now is that U.S.-led airstrikes in Syria aren't stopping ISIS, well, at least not yet, and the Kurdish fighters on the ground are asking for ground support. Will the U.S. be sending troops to fight ISIS on the ground? What do you think?
Again, that's going to depend on various factors on what's going to happen. And again, I'm going to go back to context and history. The Kurdish factions and the Kurdish factor has always been used and played. The Kurdish faction and the Kurdish factor was the case when we had the war with Iraq. You know, we had the northern territory and the Kurdish area. Then we always get to, okay, what's going to be Turkey's role? Are they going to be wary of what's going to happen afterwards? If this happens with us and the Kurds, and again, you're looking at the exact, the same replicate of what we had in place, what was taking place during the initial stage of war against Iraq.
Right now, the U.S. military actions in Iraq have one set of objectives, and then in Syria another. For example, Kurds in Iraq received so much aid so quickly from the United States, unlike the Kurds in Syria. What is it, like two kind of brands of Kurds, like you say? Is it wise to assume two different strategies when fighting one enemy?
Absolutely. You have the Kurds in Iran, and you're looking at a totally different characteristics and where they stand within the, there are over 25, 30 million Kurds, okay? And the Kurds in Syria, you have the Kurds in Turkey, you have the Kurds in Iraq, you have the Kurds in Iran. And right now, the game and the play being centered around the stage in Syria. And so we are looking at a different mechanism there than when we are looking at what's happening with the northern Iraq. And also you have to look at the oil factor. Okay, what do we have in Syria where the Kurds are concentrated versus what we have in northern Iraq, places such as Kirkuk? And, well, do we have the oil factor in play there or we don't have it there? So if you start putting those kinds of information that comes with each region and the different sects versus, let's say, in this case, Kurds, and you're looking at several different factors in play. You're not looking at only one. So you're not looking at Kurdish faction and here are the Kurds and trying to basically put them all in the same bucket. It all depends on the geostrategic facts and what you're facing, what we have, what is in play, what is at stake. And then again, you can never compare northern Iraq with what's happening with Syria and the Kurdish region in Syria.
Yeah, because I was thinking maybe they're not helping the Kurds in Syria because they're affiliated with the Kurds in Turkey, and America maybe doesn't want to upset Turkey being one of its greatest allies, no?
No, not really, because you had exactly the same scenario with the Kurds in northern Iraq and the Kurds inside Turkey. And if you look at the border region and the cross-border activities between the Kurds in Iraq and in Kurds in Turkey, we had exactly the same situation. And this was one of the main reasons that Turkey did not want to allow the United States using its air base during the early stage of the war against Iraq. It was about the Kurds in northern Iraq and how that would upset the equilibrium that the Turkish government wants to preserve and keep in place as far as the Kurdish faction is concerned.
Now, the former CIA chief and ex-defense secretary Leon Panetta said the U.S. is looking at least 30-year war against ISIS, which is not at all what the White House is telling the public. Is he exaggerating?
Well, I would say it's a very short period. I'm really surprised because we just talk about the brand change. The war against Al-Qaeda was declared as a forever war, and it has been expanding. I mean, the war against Al-Qaeda started when it was supposed to be in Afghanistan, and we started chasing Al-Qaeda in Yemen and Pakistan with all the drone attacks, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. And the fact that this was going to be a forever war, and now that the brand has changed to ISIS, I'm very surprised that former CIA director is stamping it with such a short time period. I believe 30-year period is very short, unless they have already implanted other sects or the other factions that they are going to declare the world's most dangerous terrorists. I would say it's a very short period of time. We currently are more interested in an ongoing, never-ending perpetual war. So I would say if you compare it with what we have been characterizing or our government and the media, Al-Qaeda, I would say I'm surprised that he has put such a short time stamp on ISIS, considering the attraction or the attractiveness of the brand, because it has the word Islam built into it. And let's just forget Al-Qaeda. I mean, Al-Qaeda was just the noun, you know, the name. And in this case, you're looking at a far-reaching implications when you declare the current greatest threat with an organization that has the word Islam built into it. And I think it's much more attractive to be used. So I would say, yeah, it should be forever. I'm surprised it's 30 years.
Now, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden blamed Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Turkey for helping extremists in Syria. But then he later apologized for his comments. But was he right?
Okay, so rather than dignify people like Biden, let's talk about, again, context and history. My website, our news organization, was the first one to really break within the United States the training of the Syrian rebels in Turkey. And this was about 6 to 9 months before anything about Syria actually made it into the news. And using U.S. airbase, and this is in southern Turkey, close to the border with the Syria. And this was NATO and the United States factions training and arming and sending them back, having them cross the border, rebels, long before actually it became news, Syria. And again, as I said, this was done in Turkey by the NATO's forces, mainly U.S. and British forces. And it was something that was planned and designed and implemented by the United States. So for Joe Biden to come and right now, you know, putting this out, of course, he will get away with it because the mainstream media here, they're not going to go and revisit the facts that were exposed with the activities of U.S., what they did in Turkey, training these factions. I mean, now it's called ISIS. It's like French fries or the freedom fries. You're looking exactly the same fries at the same price. So that's all I'm going to say. It is just ludicrous. And then he took it back because it upset the current president in Turkey, Erdogan. And I wouldn't even find it really newsworthy, but it's funny.
Well, why is it more important for Sunni countries like Qatar or Turkey to bring down President Assad than to contain extremism? Because you have Saudis and Qataris helping the anti-Assad rebels and the Turks asking Kurds to turn against Assad before they get any help with ISIS. Why?
In reality, if you're looking at the factual, objective analysis of it, really, it's not to their advantage whatsoever. I mean, you just name the countries. For example, Turkey is a member of NATO, and Turkey is greatly managed and directed by the United States, has been for several decades. There's no question about that. And when you're looking at United Emirates and the countries within the region, you know, including Saudi Arabia, you're looking at the tentacles of the United States. I call them the tentacle nations. So if you start looking at saying, what is their advantage? Of course, there are no advantages, and you only look at disadvantages. If you start polling people within these countries, and I can speak to Turkey, for example, if you start getting the opinion polls in Turkey, you will see that over 90% of people in Turkey are against such moves. And Turkey had a pretty good relationship with Assad and with Syria. I know they engage in some really good level of commerce, and there has been zero advantage. They have to implement policies created, designed, and issued by the United States, by NATO, and that's what they are doing. So to answer your question, it has never been a question of any other nations, especially in the region, their interests or their advantages or even comparative advantages. It has always been about what is designed, what is put in place, what orders are issued here in the United States, and that's the end of it. And the other people's interest, the other nation's interest, is not even in the equation. It's never been. And if you ask the populace, people in those nations, they would actually nod and they would say, yes, that's exactly what they believe because that's the reality.
All right, here's another possible and interesting turn of events. FBI Chief Mike Comey warned terrorists are working on an effort to attack the United States very, very soon. Is the U.S. ready to respond?
Well, again, we have to look at different things and say why this statement was made. Is it based on some sort of facts and real solid intelligence gathered? Or is it the fact that, for example, we have had for the TSA and for the flights, you know, the threat level has been really low. And when that goes for a long time, people, they get antsy. They say, well, you know, this is really annoying to have all these screens out there and going through them. We haven't had any terrorist threats, really. The level has not been blinking red or even orange. It's been yellow. Let's go through the rainbow colors. So it's time to re-energize the Americans with the fear of terrorism. We need to have more expenditure for things to put in place because we can go ahead and increase the threat level within the airports. Let me give you an example. If you look at the stock market and look at the stock prices for all the military industrial complex related companies and firms, you will see how they have just gone up tremendously since the brand from Al-Qaeda switched to ISIS. And this is, again, the brand change I'm referring to. This is when you say, yes, now we can go ahead and produce and sell more to the government and spend billions more. So the same thing is true for the internal security, fear-mongering factors on the ground in the United States. It's time to re-energize that fear. And that's exactly what they are doing. And what's going to follow this is going to be more measures put in place, whether it's within the airports or whether it's the hiring within the FBI or increasing the number of informants. Those are the things that are going to follow this announcement. We have to have more expenditure because of the fear level is going to go up, and therefore those expenditures are going to be justified. And it's as simple as that.
The FBI also says that dozens of Americans are believed to be fighting in Syria with rebel groups. How did that happen?
Well, it has to happen. Even if it's not the case, it has to happen because you're looking at how ordinary Americans perceive these things. Well, think about it. Syria and this area, you know, that region in Iraq, they are thousands of miles away. What can they do to us from there? So it's not enough to raise the terror threat and really do some heavy duty fear mongering. But if you bring some U.S. elements and ties in there, if we have Americans who are there, who are going to come back here and they're going to start be our boogeyman here on the ground, that they're going to blow up buildings, that's going to be marketing-wise more attractive. So it's going to be easier to sell to the American public the notion of our war against ISIS. We're not going to hear much of Al-Qaeda for a while. So Al-Qaeda is going to disappear and exit the stage, replaced by ISIS. So yes, that's another marketing strategy. If you start looking at some of what has been happening and what is being put forth by these people, including the former CIA director and the U.S. media, and if you start looking at it from the marketing perspective, we get to find more answers and understand what's going on rather than trying to approach this through some logical, political, philosophical, or even sociological analysis. And I think the best model that fits what's happening right now and explains it is the marketing model. And we should look at it as such.
Twitter is suing the FBI because it is not allowed to tell the public when the government asks for surveillance help. Why is surveilling Twitter such a big deal for U.S. government? So much really depend on Twitter and other social media?
No. Why surveilling all the Americans through NSA with their phone, every single phone conversation is such an important thing for the government? And again, I'm going to take us back and say, what kind of reaction from the public does this create? I mean, when we hear every day of how much is being gathered from the Facebook, it's true, and what's being gathered and collected and how people are being monitored through their Twitters, combined with what we have already known since 2004, 2005, the expose on NSA, you have a better chance of controlling the majority, controlling the people.
Sybil, can the FBI, CIA, NSA control their information, prevent it from gaining public attention? Like, what can prevent people like you, for instance, or Ed Snowden from speaking out?
Nothing. Nothing prevents people from speaking out. I have been speaking out. I don't think the U.S. government is really bothered. If the United States government is really bothered by people who are speaking out, people like myself or some credible real whistleblowers, and if that becomes a real threat, it's very easy for them to take out those people, to eliminate them. But they are not, because it hasn't risen to that level yet. If the reach were such, and if the consequences of people speaking out really reach the real masses and brought out, you know, some reaction, then you will be looking at a totally different scenario or the reaction or action by the U.S. government. But we haven't seen it yet.
And again, that was Sybil Edmonds, author, journalist, and former FBI translator and whistleblower on the show Sophie and Company on RT. This interview was done before Russia started bombing ISIS at the request of the Syrian government. Are these two former FBI employees really, quote, horrifying trolls, as the NPR pundits have labeled them, because they question the official explanation of events? I think you're smart enough to decide that for yourselves and not have to be labeled, quote, horrifying troll by uninformed talk show hosts at NPR for questioning your government and the controlled media. In fact, these questioning citizens may be the only hope we have of ending the global war on terror and all of the other destructive things happening to our fragile planet and its people, inflicted on us all by the elite for profit and the New World Order. Sybil Edmonds has a radio show and a podcast which can be found at the website boilingfrogspost.com. And again, that's boilingfrogspost.com. I encourage you to check her website out. She's got a wealth of knowledge about 9/11 and geopolitics. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Mack. Tens of thousands of students across the country walked out of their classrooms as part of a massive national protest on gun violence spurred by the Florida high school shooting a month ago that left 17 dead. The protests unfolded in major cities across the country, New York, Washington, Chicago, Seattle, and hundreds of smaller towns and communities as well. The walkouts came before a march on Washington, hundreds of thousands of students to the nation's capital, a turnout not seen in size or scope since student protests of the Vietnam War era in the late 1960s.
Building Bridges presents more than a soundbite, but the actual speeches, the hue and cry of the young protesters, along with comprehensive interviews where they tell it like it is for them. The students are saying that their walkouts and demonstrations represent a realization of power and influence by young people raised on social media who have come of age in an era of never-ending wars, highly publicized mass shootings, and virulent national politics.
Let's listen.
My name is Anna, and I'm a senior at the Urban Assembly Institute of Math and Science. Politician, so I don't know why it's taking our country this long to devise a tactic to solve this problem. When the future voice of the country is denied their basic right to try to innovate a solution, the solution itself is stalled and prevented from being conceived. Who in their right mind passes up the chance to right a wrong that has cost too many people their lives? Now I, as many of us gathered here today, am entering college in the fall. Of the 17 lives lost in Parkland, 14 were young people that were supposed to live on and grow up to eventually do the same, but they won't. They won't walk across the stage to receive their diploma. They won't go to prom and have the best night of their lives. They don't wave their family goodbye on moving day. They won't get to experience and live their lives to the fullest. But I am here today to tell you that I will, and I will do it for them. I will do it for the 17 lives lost in Parkland, for the victims lost in the 33 other mass shootings since the start of 2018. I will do it for those lost in Orlando and those lost in Sandy Hook. Today, I use my voice for them. And I urge everyone else here to do the same. Speak for those who can no longer speak. Grow up for those who can no longer grow. Change the world for those who can no longer see the change. Live the life they can no longer live. February 14th, 17 people woke up and got ready for school. On February 14th, those same 17 did not go home to their families. This is for them.
My name is James Clinton, and I go to St. Francis College right here on Remsen Street. We all know why we're here today. Aurora, Sandy Hook, Charleston, San Bernardino, Orlando, Las Vegas, Sutherland Springs, and Parkland. Never again! These incidents have now become routine. There are those that tell us these tragedies are inevitable, that they're the price of freedom. We are the only advanced country on earth that watches this level of violence take place in our schools, our churches, our movie theaters, and our concerts. We shed tears, we send our thoughts and prayers, and we move on after the numbness subsides. But this time it's different. Thoughts and prayers be damned. We demand action. It has been exactly 1 month since Parkland, and the world is watching. If our politicians in Washington won't take action, then we will. If those in D.C. won't keep our schools safe, then we will. If those in D.C. won't ban weapons of war from entering our streets, then we will. If those in D.C. won't pass universal background checks, we will. If those in D.C. won't free the greatest country on earth from this cycle of violence, we will. Now more than ever, we must come together and demand an end to the status quo. If this generation of politicians won't stand up to the NRA, then we will. We gather here today not as cynics, but as believers. We believe in the ability of our country to end this epidemic, and we believe in ourselves to be the agents of change. We will be the generation to end school shootings. We will be the generation to end mass shootings. Never again!
I'm Alex Bavalski, a sophomore at Brooklyn Tech. Many people look at gun violence as some abstraction, some anomaly, or some exception to the norm. A side effect of the freedom that Americans get from the Second Amendment. And the NRA is just there to protect that freedom, right? Guardians of liberty. Well, let's go through the numbers. The Gun Violence Archive, a nonprofit that culls data from 2,500 media, government, and other nonprofit sources, shows that there have been 1,600 incidents where four or more people were shot, excluding the shooters, since Sandy Hook. Approximately 1,800 killed and 6,400 wounded. That's 4 1/3 casualties per day. We're not even including the shootings with less than four casualties. You know, the ones that caused 39,000 deaths in 2016 alone, nearly 23,000 of which were suicides. And after each shooting, big or small, and after all the breaking news reports and the thoughts and prayers and crying and moments of silence and protests and funerals and all this, we hear. Now is the time to pray for the loved ones of the fallen. Now is not the time to politicize gun violence. Now let's talk about the NRA and the gun rights groups that ensure no gun laws ever change. Yeah, who said that? Yeah. In 2015, 54 senators, funded by $37 million from the NRA, voted against stopping people on the government terrorist watch list from buying guns. And then all the anti-gun control people say, oh, you're taking guns from good guys. The NRA has also spent $144 million on outside spending, such as ads for or against politicians. This is unlike direct lobbying because a particular candidate is supported or trashed if it's someone for gun control without any money going to the candidate directly. Additionally, the NRA has spent $46 million on federal lobbying. What's the total? $203 million on political activities. Seems a bit shady for an organization that claims to be for individual rights. Doesn't life come before liberty? How can anyone have freedom if they're at constant risk of being shot by someone on the terrorist watch list or some mentally ill person who never had to go through a background check? Or some avowed racist like Dylann Roof, who shot up a Charleston church in 2015. So what should Congress do? End the gun show loophole and institute universal background checks. Ban assault weapons across the United States. No one needs an AR-15 for self-defense. We did this in 1994 and gun massacres fell by 37%. Once the ban expired in 2004, they rose by 183%. Las Vegas, Orlando, Parkland, San Bernardino, and countless more could have been prevented this way. It's time to put humans before the gun lobby.
I say I vote, and they say why vote. I say
their passions and beliefs with how they make a difference both at and beyond the ballot box. Your willingness to defy the status quo and shake things up to make your voice heard gives me hope. It gives me hope that young people can be real change agents pushing agendas that people like us care about. Yes, yes. If you all are not only the future leaders of tomorrow, but are the leaders of today. The leaders of today, guys. This walkout, this rally, these things are only the start. I'm here today to talk about the importance of voting and being civically engaged. Speaking truth to power means believing in what you say and fighting every day to have that heard. It means taking a risk, but it means standing for something. So with that said, why is it that we're still standing for the abysmal youth voting statistics in this nation? Why is it that we have such a hard time getting young people registered and out to vote? Why is it that in the 2016 presidential election, just 36% of 18 and 19-year-olds voted? In the 2014 midterm elections, whose stats are most emblematic of the next election cycle, just 14% of 18 and 19-year-olds voted. 14%! Is that enough? Is that enough? The youth voters are barely turning out to the polls at all. Are you tired? I'm tired of hearing my peers say things like, I'm not going to vote. My vote doesn't really matter anyway. And voting in New York means nothing. Does voting in New York mean something to you? Yeah. And the list of excuses goes on and on and on. It's frustrating. Having policies made that affect my life and my friends and my family by people I didn't put in office, it's frustrating. Yeah. So what are we going to do about it, huh? If you're serious about influencing policy and politics, the first step is finding out who represents you, studying up on what they care about, infiltrating their offices as volunteers and interns, getting involved with your local community boards, learning the process so you can use it to your advantage and one day running for office. Because who better to represent you than you? If you're frustrated with what's going on in our government, if you wish you were in those rooms debating issues you care about, you belong in those rooms, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Through letters and phone calls and elected office, the conversation is yours to own. So let's get to it.
My name is Frankie Comar, and I'm an 8th grader at Packer. It's been over 5 years since 20 first graders and 6 teachers were shot to death in Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary School. Almost 2 years since 49 lives were taken by bullets in Florida's Pulse nightclub. Less than 6 months since a whopping 59 people were murdered in Las Vegas. The deadliest mass shooting since 1966. And exactly 1 month since 17 were killed at Majority Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. While over 400 people have been shot in the more than 200 school shootings that have occurred since 2012, that's just a small piece of the pie. Guns aren't just a problem in schools, they're a problem everywhere. And they are a problem that we will get rid of! Not because we're anti-America and fighting against the Constitution. Because we are pro-America and we want to protect our people! Yes! Guns are just as about American as lynching. They serve as bloody ways for people to bypass the court system, to sentence others to the death penalty without a just trial. And with guns so accessible to the general public, it's now easier than ever. You can legally purchase a gun from a gun show without receiving a background check. You can upgrade so many basic guns to semi-automatic or fully automatic tools capable of taking more lives in mere minutes than any of us can fully comprehend. In some states, it's easier to get a gun than it is to get a driver's license. This has to stop. It's gone on too long. Enough waiting for people to do this for us. Enough standing by while our parents, our sisters, our brothers are being ripped apart by bullets. Enough procrastinating. It's not too late to make change, but we're pushing it. We have to take action now. The blood of too many children has been mopped off of school floors, but these innocent people have not died in vain. We will avenge their deaths. Not by shooting, not by fighting, but by chanting, by marching, by petitioning, by forcing our superiors to rectify the outdated laws that plague this country, so that our lives won't be cut short, so that our children will be able to focus on learning without the fear of gunshots ringing through their classrooms. Because we deserve better than that.
Hi, my name is Rudy, and I'm an 11th grader at Brooklyn Technical High School.
My name is Anna, and I'm also an 11th grader at Brooklyn Technical High School.
Let it be known that the greatest and most revolutionary movements in history have been started by students.
Only a couple of days ago, a 17-year-old black student from Huffman High in Alabama was killed. Her name was Cortland Arrington, and she was a month away from turning 18. She had already been accepted to college and was planning to study nursing. So far, very few mainstream media outlets have reported on her death. We stand here today, not only for Parkland students, but for the forgotten, like Horton.
This is for all the black women and black girls who have succumbed to gun violence tied with racism and misogyny in this country. This is for black students fighting against the gun violence that disproportionately targets their communities. Black kids are 10 times more likely to die by gun violence compared to their non-black counterparts. Remember Cortland Arrington. Say her name and never forget it. Remember all the other black women who lost their lives due to gun violence. Remember that this movement was started by students. This is for us and by us.
From speeches today, we have heard about the gun problem in America. The absurd amount of deaths at the hands of gun violence. We have let politicians know about our demands, and we have heard about gun violence and its relationship to minorities and how it adversely affects them at a rate far greater than it does than our white counterparts. The gun laws in America make no sense and have no place in America currently. We were here to cause change. And we were here to make sure that this tragic event that we were gathered here today for will never happen again, because we know that gun violence in America can be stifled. We know that the AR-15 assault rifle is a killing machine. We know that background checks are absolutely necessary. And we know that being able to evade one at a gun show is unacceptable. And we know that it makes no sense for someone to purchase a weapon at 18. But why? But why don't our politicians know this? I say that it's time we let our politicians know what we think, and it's time that we let them know what we want. It's our time to create change. It's our time to lead the conversation on gun violence. And it's our time to go to the polls this November and vote with our voice. Enough is enough. Stop the silence and the violence. Stop the silence and the violence. Stop the silence and the violence.
So I
know that you all wanted to speak but didn't get a chance. Yeah. So now you have your chance. You are?
My name is Fatima Youssef. I'm from Brooklyn Technical High School. I'm a junior and I'm 16 years old. I feel no one really mentioned the cause for gun violence. The majority of acts of violence through guns are committed by men. It's the way that we've raised our boys. It's the way that we've let them down. And now this aggression built up from emotional trauma for not being able to express any of these emotions before because they gotta be a man. It's firing off every time they fire a bullet of a gun. And we haven't even talked about the victims of gun violence. Like, we always want to say, oh, mentally ill people, we can't have them get their hands on guns because they're going to shoot up people. But mentally ill people are usually the victims of gun violence, portray them as the perpetrators of it. And we haven't talked about the violence against women and how so many domestic violence cases involve women being shot by guns. I know we want to talk about the AR-15s, and I understand we want to put our anger on one thing, but we need to get change done. If we are not addressing the root causes of all of this, then how are we going to get any change done?
Well, let me take you up on that. Yes, I think that's a very astute and fundamental point. Let me push it a little further. We also have a president who, and I see that your friend here is a Muslim sister.
Yes.
Where do you think Donald Trump, where do you think the administration fits into this pattern, this culture of misogyny, of violence against people of color, violence against Muslims, violence against immigrants?
Both her and I are Muslims, actually. And I've noticed the president...
And I should say that's your friend who's standing a couple of inches back from us, looking like she has nothing to do with us.
I feel like the current administration and the administrations before that, they've always loved this idea that Muslims are the ones perpetrating the violence. And there's this whole entire idea that people of color, women, people in the LGBT, people of religious minorities, they're subhuman. This idea of white supremacy in general. A lot of my friends also think in the same way that I do, and we usually have way more in-depth analysis about all of this. It's just, my thoughts are all over the place because it's really cold right now. But you also see, like, other kids who end up writing racial slurs on the walls, graffitiing, drawing swastikas, and just, when we had the walkout at our school, we had a mini, like, counter-protest where telling jokes, laughing along while we had the moment of...
These were students from Brooklyn Tech and accounting?
Yes.
That's interesting.
So it's not even like this whole entire ideological discussion, because we have it on both the wide scale of a country where either people don't understand the gravity of the situation, because the victims, they're just seen as nothing. Like, to be able to make a joke.
So where do you go from here? Where do you take it? Where does your friend who continues to inch back from us?
Because
what do you teach us? What do you teach in society? Where does this need to go next?
I think we need to continue to educate ourselves. You can't have democracy without it. We all have power. We keep acting like they were talking about voting before, how my vote's not going to count. It will count. And we need to start fighting more and more.
What do you think about what your friend said? You see, I can't help but draw you into this.
Yeah, it's
you started this.
I'm a horrible speaker, but
I doubt that.
Yeah, but I really do agree with her, and I think that like a lot of people, they just don't care enough, and they're not doing enough. But now, today, like, this is going to change everything. I hope, and I hope that the government listens. I hope they all listen, and they don't just, like, you know, throw away this whole protest. And hopefully no one else in the future, no more kids have to worry about getting shot in their schools or, you know, being in danger when they're trying to learn in, like, this world. I hope that never happens again. And if it does, maybe it'll be better in the future.
Gee, for somebody who claims they don't speak so well, I'm deeply moved and impressed. One other thing. Tell me who you are.
Oh, I'm Tasina Khan. I'm a freshman at Brooklyn Tech.
Well, Brooklyn Tech is certainly in the house with the two of you. And just very, very quickly, lastly, so what do you think the next step is? What needs to be done?
I think we need to place the energy within our schools, first of all. If we're talking about school gun violence, we need to start reaching out to kids more and more. Because, personally speaking, as someone who has been within the mental health system, in hospitals and stuff, like for my school specifically, we have had a lot of children end up in psychiatric hospitals. And it's not just, like, the fault of the kids. Since it's such a trend, we need to protect our kids not just from forces outside, but from whatever may be harming them from within as well. So we need to reach out to kids more. I think that's the very first step. And then we take it from there.
I think I agree with her, but I also think that the first step is to make it harder to get a gun. Why is it so easy to get a gun? And one of the features in some states is easier to get a gun than it is to get a license. And that's crazy. So, I mean, before everyone starts fighting, I think first we should get harder tests to make it harder to get a gun. But I do think that I don't think a lot of people need guns.
Yeah, you think we need teachers who are even better in the schools? We don't need teachers with guns. Oh my gosh!
And like to arm teachers with guns, like we, especially within like so-called within the when we talk about racism, the fact that we've asked students in classes who have, you know, just for like talking or chewing gum or something, being pulled out of their desks, slammed onto the ground, and handcuffed and taken away by the police. So, and there are so many other disciplinary measures taken, especially against Black students. And I'm kind of weary of arming certain teachers with guns because I feel I personally don't trust them at all.
Yeah, I don't think that people just forget that, you know, some teachers could have mental illnesses.
But it's not even like mentally ill people are usually
It's not only
so you don't have to be mentally ill to kill people.
But I agree. I'm sorry. But,
well, I want to thank both of you. Obviously, the dialogue continues.
Yeah.
It was a delight meeting both of you. And, you know, as they said in a number of struggles in years past, La Luta Continua, which was in Portuguese, the struggle does continue.
Yes.
Thank you so much. And tell us again who you are.
I'm Fatwa Yusuf.
I'm Fasina Khan.
And out of the mouth of babes. And as they say, a child will lead. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
When I first heard about two new books for people coming out of heterosexual marriages, I thought, good, someone needs to talk about how this is done ethically.
In 1930, Variety magazine reported, only he-men are wanted by the studio for Chorus Boys. If too pretty, dainty, or over-marcelled, he is aired off the casting list.
I knew that I had good intentions, but also that I had so much to learn about the LGBTQ community and the world in general.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A London married couple appeals for recognition in Northern Ireland. Two books help guide lesbians and gays out of heterosexual marriages. And a young straight ally offers insights for those who want to join him. All that and more this week because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending March 17th, 2018. Oral arguments concluded this week in a marriage equality case in the Court of Appeal of the only major area of the United Kingdom without it, Northern Ireland. Plaintiffs in the case, known as Petition X, are an anonymous Northern Ireland gay couple who legally married in London in 2014. Northern Ireland only recognizes the marriages of same-gender couples conducted in other parts of the UK as civil partnerships. The couple filed their appeal after the Belfast High Court ruled against them, deciding that only lawmakers could enact equality. The couple contends that downgrading their marriage to a civil partnership is a human rights violation that unlawfully discriminates against their rights to privacy, family life, and religious freedom. Even though a majority of Northern Ireland Assembly members voted for a marriage equality bill in 2015, the ultra-conservative Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, has used what are called petitions of concern to overrule any effort to legislate on the issue. The current Assembly is not functioning because the DUP and the equality-supporting Sinn Féin Party have been unable to reach a power-sharing agreement. Opening civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples has been one of the major stumbling blocks.
The Northern Ireland Assembly and the British government are each named as defendants. Lawyers for the British government argued that there was never intended to be a one-size-fits-all approach to the legal recognition of same-gender couples across the UK, and that the gay couple's ability to wed in England, but not Northern Ireland, was a matter of policy rather than a legal matter. Lawyers for the gay couple stressed that their case differed from another case working its way through the courts that has been filed by same-gender couples seeking the right to marry in Northern Ireland. But it is similar to a lawsuit to be heard in May in the British Overseas Territory of Bermuda. That lawsuit involves the downgrading of existing marriage equality in the Caribbean nation to domestic partnerships. The three-judge appeals court panel hearing the Petition X case, led by Lord Chief Justice Sir Declan Morgan, pledged this week to deliver a verdict as soon as possible.
U.S. Vice President Mike Pence came under fire this week when he broke with long-standing tradition and banned the press from covering the Vice President's St. Patrick's Day breakfast with an Irish leader. This year, it was openly gay Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar. Pence allowed the press to cover his official greeting as Varadkar arrived at the vice presidential residence in the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., but he ignored questions shouted by reporters about why the meeting itself was being held behind closed doors. The fact that Pence is well known for his anti-queer views and that Varadkar is openly gay and an ardent equality supporter suggests that Trump administration officials didn't want any conversation embarrassing to the vice president to be recorded and reported. Varadkar told the Irish press last week that he intended to raise the issue of LGBT rights with the vice president. He said afterwards that the private meeting probably allowed the two politicians to have a frank conversation.
Elsewhere, a transgender boy in the U.S. state of Maryland has won the right to use the school bathroom and locker room of his choice. U.S. District Court Judge George L. Russell III ruled this week that the claims of the student, known in the suit as M.A.B., come down to a boy asking his school to treat him just like any other boy. Russell found that Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause provide MAB grounds to do so. Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 bans the denial of benefits or any form of discrimination based on sex in all federally funded education programs. Russell stopped short of issuing an injunction against the school district and ordered their officials and attorneys for MAB, who's represented by the Maryland LGBT Advocacy Group, Free State Justice, and the ACLU, to resolve the matter before the school year begins again in September. Russell's ruling mirrors several other court decisions that Title IX does protect trans students. Donald Trump's Education Department reversed an Obama-era policy that supported those protections and now refuses to consider any gender identity-based discrimination complaints from transgender students.
Brazil's Supreme Court ruled last week that the government can no longer require transgender people who want to change the gender designation on their identification documents to first undergo psychiatric evaluation and gender reassignment surgery or get a court's approval. According to Human Rights Watch, Argentina was the first country on the planet to allow the ID change without surgery or court approval in 2012. Colombia, Denmark, Ireland, Norway, Malta, and now Brazil have since followed suit. Recognizing people's self-identified gender is not asking governments to acknowledge any new or special rights, a Human Rights Watch statement said. Instead, it is a commitment to the core idea that governments will not decide for people who they are. Despite its live-and-let-live reputation, Brazil has the highest number of murders of transgender people in the world. The Brazilian charity ANTRA, which tracks those killings, said that 179 cross-dressers and trans people were killed in 2017 alone, which amounts to one murder every 48 hours. And those are just the cases that were reported. The group's founder, Kyla Simpson, told the Washington Blade newspaper that, "We live in a country where it is allowed to kill, where religious fanaticism sharpens its knife daily to decimate our community, and where the prejudice faced by transgender people starts inside their homes."
Gays and lesbians are also frequent targets of violence in Brazil. Rio de Janeiro City Council member Mariela Franco, an out black lesbian human rights activist who campaigned against police abuse in the city's poorest neighborhoods, was gunned down this week. 3 days of mourning have been declared. Even though the area's residents have become numb to almost daily violence, the drive-by assassination prompted a wave of anger and social media-fueled street demonstrations. A crowd of several thousand people gathered outside her city council offices on March 15th, brandishing placards charging that Franco was executed by an out-of-control military police force recently brought in by the federal government to curb drug-related violence. Critics charge that the military police force has done little to dent the drug trade, but has harassed and abused civilians and needs to be disbanded. Investigators agree that the 38-year-old activist was the victim of a targeted assassination, but officials won't say by whom. Her driver, Anderson Pedro Gomez, was also killed, and an aide was injured when, according to police reports, two men in a car drew alongside her vehicle, shot into the car 9 times, and sped away. One of Franco's last posts on Twitter highlighted the shooting death of a young man, describing it as another homicide that could be credited to the police. She'd previously called a military police unit the Battalion of Death because of the number of civilians shot by its officers. Well-known out investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald mourned Franco's death, noting on Twitter that she had a 19-year-old daughter, an amazing girlfriend and family. The political consequences will be strong. A number of global rights groups, including Human Rights Watch, have also condemned the killing. Police spokesman said that investigators were not yet sure about a motive, but promised a thorough postmortem. Cynics are not holding their collective breath.
In other news, the longtime face of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, Kate Kendall, announced this week that she's stepping down after 22 years as its executive director. Kendall grew up Mormon in Ogden, Utah, migrated to San Francisco, and began her career with the center as legal director in 1994. She was named executive director 2 years later. Kendall announced her departure on the group's blog. I feel enormous gratitude to have been a part of the NCLR legacy, part of the history of the fight, still ongoing, for full lived justice for all LGBTQ people, she wrote. The leaders of virtually every other queer rights group in the country praised Kendall for her dedication and leadership. I am forever beholden to you all for making me better. The honor truly has been all mine, she wrote, signing off with mad love and respect.
And finally,
let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore.
You may be among the millions of viewers of a viral video showing a drag queen dressed as Elsa from the Disney hit Frozen during this week's blizzard, single-handedly pushing a stuck police van out of a snowdrift in South Boston. He can then be seen curtsying for the camera and triumphantly sashaying in the snow, singing, "Let It Go." The 37-year-old lawyer in real life, Jason Triplett, said he dressed in the blue dress and blonde braided wig to give his friends at the nearby Gallows Bar a laugh. Enjoying his 15 minutes of fame, Triplett told BuzzFeed that he wouldn't go on the Ellen DeGeneres show unless Adam Rippon was there. When asked during an Entertainment Tonight interview about Triplett's amazing feat, Rippon himself offered a perfect salute.
They say not all heroes wear capes, but sometimes they do.
Cole never bothered me anyway.
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending March 17th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
I'm scared of being ignorant. There's something frightening about not being aware of the truth.
A young ally goes to school later in the program.
Whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, whether I find a place in this world or never belong, I've got to be me. I've got to be me. What else can I be but what I am?
For a special group of people who need to sing that song, two handbooks to help the heterosexually married come out have caught the eye of This Way Out Queer Life and Lit commentator Janet Mason and deepened her compassion for their situation.
When I first heard about two new books for people coming out of heterosexual marriages, I thought, good. Someone needs to talk about how this is done ethically. In other words, honesty is the best policy, and this means not living a double life for any reason. I was not disappointed. In fact, both books evoked compassion on my part. As a longtime lesbian feminist with a long-term partner in a world that has seen many advances in LGBT rights, I managed to stay in a bubble where it seems like homophobia rarely touches me. And when it does, I manage to get away. But these two books focus on the rest of the world where rights are under attack. Indeed, where progress is met with a backlash. Sadly, this world does exist. As Darshana Matani writes in Greetings from Jane Land, edited by Candace Walsh and Barbara Strauss Lodge, and published by Cleus Press. As an Indian daughter in Barbados, I was told who I was before I could figure it out for myself. My whole life was a preamble to marriage. How to budget for groceries, remove greasy stains from marble tables, make chai, entertain and dress accordingly, pay compliments, satisfy my husband, impress the in-laws, and most importantly, listen without having an opinion. So how to get out of an arranged marriage, or for that matter, any heterosexual marriage? The answers lie in the pages of this book, which is organized into short stories focusing on the experiences of each woman. Many other writers are mothers. Some were raised in strict religious traditions, Others come from small towns, and others come from diverse ethnic backgrounds. More than a few were terrified of losing their children and the support of their families. But they did manage to leave heterosexual marriages that were not working for them. In the process, they are able to create lives where they define themselves. Married Man Coming Out, Create Space by David Christel. It is a step-by-step guide for coming out with a goal, as he puts it in the subtitle, to become the man you were born to be. Christel starts off with the sage advice of paying attention to your emotions. As he writes, I know you're a guy, so checking in on your feelings isn't what you do. Do it anyway. Not dealing with your feelings is a cultural myth about men that has been promulgated for eons. Men don't feel, men do. Yet men do have feelings that are fundamental to their being. The author then goes on to make suggestions for telling the female spouse. Her pain is going to be palpable. Whatever you do, don't go stoic on her or let yourself be vulnerable with her. After all, you did marry her and you may have had children with her. Your marriage is based on something and you need to have that come through. This way, she won't feel completely abandoned by you and let feelings of worthlessness overtake her. This book is written with humor interlaced through it and is very comprehensive. Christel includes coming out to children, other family members, old friends, co-workers, and even touches on the gay community. He also mentions support groups for coming out and also groups for dealing with addiction. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and leisure for This Way Out.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights. An informed community is a strong community. That's why I'm inviting you to tune in to this station to hear This Way Out.
I realized that I was troubled by what I understood as my complacency with my ignorance. So I felt that I needed to find a way not only to help end ignorance in others, but also within myself.
Declaring yourself an ally is one thing, but that may be just the first step. Wise counsel from a young straight activist is coming up, but first...
And now for something completely different.
After a classic satiric setup, Hollywood's early emphasis on uber-masculinity is remembered in A Rainbow Minute.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day.
He's a lumberjack.
Cut down trees, I eat my lunch, I go to the lavatory. On Wednesdays I go shopping and have buttered scones for tea.
He cuts down trees, eats his lunch, he goes to the lavatory. On Wednesdays he goes shopping and has buttered scones for tea.
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night and I work all day. I cut down trees, I skip and jump, I like to press wildflowers. I put on women's clothing and hang around in bars.
He cuts down trees, he skips and jumps, he likes to press wildflowers. He puts on women's clothing and hang around in bars.
Only He-Men in the Chorus. Coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. In the early 1930s, there was a concerted effort to ban depictions of homosexuality in films. Instigated by Catholic reformers and put into place by the movie industry itself, the details were spelled out in what was called the Production Code. Studio chiefs were forced to weed out the gay actors. In 1930, Variety magazine reported, "Only He-Men are wanted by the studio for chorus boys. Each chorus boy is individually considered. If too pretty, dainty, or over-marcelled, he is aired off the casting list." Matinee idols like William Haynes were pressured to arrange a marriage of convenience. In the end, Haynes' contract with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was not renewed, since he refused to go along with studio publicity that would have hidden his homosexuality. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, John DeBoer.
Have you checked our website lately?
For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
Taking a stand as a straight supporter of LGBTQ people doesn't necessarily mean you worked out all of your own misconceptions and prejudices. A straight member of Outcasting Overtime looks inward to examine his fear of being ignorant and his motivations for working with the queer community.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Quinn, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Max talks about his story about joining Outcasting as a straight ally. Max chooses to focus on the idea of ignorance and how Outcasting has helped him personally learn and teach others about the LGBTQ community.
I used to think that stories that I read in school were stupid. In my freshman year of high school, a time when I didn't have the ability to think for myself, my English class read The Allegory of the Cave. My mind was blown as Plato's story challenged the idea of ignorance, and I began to appreciate more of what I read in class. The Allegory of the Cave is a story of prisoners who are chained down to only face the backside of a cave. They suffer from having a skewed sense of reality, as their understanding of the world comes solely from the shadows they see on the walls. When a prisoner is freed from his position, his changing understandings baffle him. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that's the gist of it. This was the first story that I read in school that had an impact on me. Ever since reading it, I've always had a fear of being one of those prisoners. Not that I'm scared of being chained down in a cave, but I'm scared of being ignorant. There's something frightening about not being aware of the truth. Now, you may be wondering how all this talk of Plato and ignorance plays into my role at Outcasting. Well, in part, Outcasting has become a way for me to take off my chains and learn about the world. At least the worlds of the LGBTQ community, activism, and leadership. I grew up in a home and a town that are pretty accepting of all kinds of people, and when I was very young, it seemed to me that society was perfect. In my elementary school days, my understanding of the world was that discrimination and bigotry were things of the past. To a third grader, the civil rights movement of the 1960s felt like centuries ago. I was inspired by photographs of the Little Rock Nine and wished I could have been there to join in the fight for justice. Obviously, race isn't the only reason why people are discriminated against, as the LGBTQ community still struggles for equality. Growing up as a teenage boy, I was constantly surrounded by the F-word. While the four-letter F-word doesn't bother me, the six-letter one that is derogatory towards gay people did. For some reason, for guys, using that word is just a thing to do, to be cool. And I understand that my friends don't mean to be hateful, but that's the effect they're having. That always bothered me, how they could be hurting someone unintentionally. I never wanted to do that, and my fear of ignorance was always playing in the back of my head. One night, I think when I was a freshman, my mom and I were having a conversation about family friends who happened to be a happily married gay couple. My mom casually shared that she wondered who was the husband and who was the wife in the relationship. I knew she didn't have the slightest bit of hatred in her, but she just didn't know that the question she had asked was a bit offensive. I was slightly taken aback, just as I had been with my friends. After explaining to her that their marriage wasn't defined by traditional rules, I was forced to pose a question to myself. If my parents, who are accepting and loving individuals, make unintentionally hurtful comments, do I? Did I make microaggressions? Was I ignorant? I quickly came to the conclusion that surely I was. I knew that I had good intentions, but also that I had so much to learn about the LGBTQ community and the world in general. I realized that I was troubled by what I understood as my complacency with my ignorance, so I felt that I needed to find a way not only to help end ignorance in others, but also within myself. A couple of years later, in June of my junior year in high school, Alex, one of the assistant producers here at Outcasting, stopped by my school one day to talk about Outcasting. Walking into the meeting, I had thought that I was going to hear about a radio station like 102.7 or another average music radio station. After hearing Alex share what Outcasting does in giving youth a voice and sharing their views and knowledge of the LGBTQ community, I was blown away. It felt like the perfect opportunity for me to learn about myself and teach others while being an activist. I signed up to join in the summer of 2017, and ever since then, I've constantly been learning about the LGBTQ community. In every session, I learn about the community, not only through the research I do, but also by talking to my peers here at the studio. When we goof off and talk about our lives, I learn what it's like to be gay, bi, trans, or the range of identities I find at Outcasting. At first, I was a bit apprehensive about joining because I was scared that as a straight person, I might be trivializing other people's experiences. I soon found that this was ridiculous because although I'm not a member of the LGBTQ community, I'm supportive and truly open to learning about it, and that's what matters in being an activist. Anyway, although I don't understand everything, joining Outcasting has helped me be a bit less ignorant about the LGBTQ community and teach others as well.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you. If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue. And we're all here in it together.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Michael LeBeau and Tanya Kane Perry, with thanks to Steve Fried, John DeBoer, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, Quinn and Max from Outcasting Overtime, produced by Mark Soffice, and from Janet Mason. Billy Porter, Monty Python, Bette Midler, and A Great Big World performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KEUL, Girdwood and Hope, Alaska, 3CR, Fitzroy, Victoria, WHYR, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station, where our big birthday bash is coming soon, so stay tuned.
Thank you. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. While the dangers of climate change have been known for many decades, almost nothing has been done to limit greenhouse gas emissions. And while the perils from global warming will only increase in the future, the climate crisis is here already. Given that, Jeff Mann and his co-author Joel Wainwright argue that we need to be asking ourselves about the possible political futures we face in a warming world, both authoritarian and potentially egalitarian. In their much-anticipated book, Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future, Wainwright and Mann posit that various paths are possible, although one route is most likely. Jeff, let me begin by asking you why we're in the situation we find ourselves, where those in power did almost nothing to stop global warming.
We're definitely at a point, as you say, where we have done virtually nothing. In fact, one might even argue we've done worse than nothing because we didn't even slow down, really. We just talked about slowing down a lot. We gathered together and patted each other on the back for talking about slowing down several times. But for the most part, we have continued on business as usual, as they say. And I think that a full and probably, you know, justifiable explanation of how we got there would be so expansive as to be, you know, halfway between overwhelming and trivial insofar as it tried to tie everything in. In the book, Joel and I, and in other books that we really admire, like, for example, Andreas Malm's Fossil Capital, he ties Malm, and Joel and I would agree on this front, he ties the development of the problem, you know, to the emergence of a fossil fuel-based capitalism and its rapid acceleration and expansion over time across the globe. And I think that even if one need not go back to the 1840s and 50s and think of these people as secretly, you know, warming the globe and they knew it and they had a conspiracy to keep it from us all. Of course, that's not true. We can still nonetheless associate the massive destruction associated with climate change, as you say, going on now, has gone on in the past, and will, of course, be worse in the future. We can associate that very much with an organization of economic life driven by the expansive demands of capitalism, demands that have, you know, pushed aside concerns for human rights, for ecological justice, and for, I think, reasonable expectations of a democratic polity entirely over time.
Well, just in terms of thinking about capitalism itself, there were people who have, in effect, looked the other way while global warming has accelerated, who you would imagine would stand to lose with the kind of havoc that's being wreaked on the planet through climate change. I'm talking here about the capitalist class, that at some point, and maybe that point has already arrived in different sectors, won't this bite into their profits? And how does it affect our understanding of their inaction?
Right. That is a fascinating question. I'm not sure that I have any, you know, better insight into that than all the other people who have been struggling, like you, to figure out the answer to that question. It does seem like the basic tenets of sort of liberal self-interest would suggest that it would have been smart to rethink this a while back. And that clearly didn't happen. I think, you know, we could turn to the sort of standard explanations. And by standard, I don't mean, you know, untrue by any means. You know, the sort of institutional inertia. There is definitely built into many social formations a kind of myopia and expectation that that tomorrow will be like today. And in fact, I think assuming that relationship, some sort of consistency over time, is pretty fundamental to most, not just institutions, but social relationships. We know we organize ourselves around a view of things staying reasonably similarly over time. So there's those sort of standard explanations of the kind of why we didn't do anything. But I also think that there are other ways in which the institutional tweaks, the increasing interdigitation or, you know, complex links that have been built up between capitalism, capitalists, and the modern capitalist state have made it possible to not only ignore but even exacerbate the forces driving climate change, because as of yet, those haven't actually affected the bottom line, as you might say, or profit rates. They have actually arguably, you know, improved the situation, especially of the capitalists at the top. And so insofar as we're trying to explain their lack of action, we could also turn to a relatively straightforward, you know, explanation on the flip side and say, actually, they've benefited enormously from that inaction, and persistent resistance to inaction moving forward into the future, that has taught them that pays very well. So that, on the other hand, is not very surprising. Again, this is not a comprehensive explanation by any means, but I think there are many, many, many forces kind of over-determining what we might think of as sort of heels dug in resistance.
Well, in your book, you argue that the most serious effects from climate change won't only be ecological, but also political, and that climate change will fundamentally reshape the societies that we live in, and that is the circumstances of climate change. And you imagine a number of different possible paths along which societies might go, and some of them are paths where the future will be determined from above and some from below, and we'll talk about the from below ones later in the program. But I wonder if you could lay out the possible paths that you see the societies following, obviously bearing in mind that we're talking about very uneven and different societies around the world.
Joel and I are trying to say exactly as you've framed it there, that to frame it in the way that I'm just about to isn't to say that we're the only ones who've realized that this has political implications. But it is the case that I think sometimes when we think about the impacts of climate change, we do understandably have a tendency to think explicitly about what we might think of as the environmental changes that are afoot. You know, say a lack of drinking water in particular places in the world, or the melting of the ice caps and associated sea level rise. We tend to think of climate change as playing out in the natural world, let's say. But as you said, Joel and I focused the book on the sort of unspoken or reasonably less often spoken flip side of that, which is, of course, that politics won't stay the same. And there'll be many, many challenges to our the political organization societies that will be driven by the kinds of environmental shifts that we're talking about. For example, if we think of a sea level rise that makes huge parts of the coastal Asia uninhabitable because they are underwater, then we're going to see massive movements of people that put pressures on food supplies and other societies, the places that they move, the so-called problem of the climate refugee. That's just sort of one of the more glaring versions of the ways that these problems will put pressure on our political institutions. And so the goal of the book is to think about, the world is going to change. That seems to us to be incontrovertible. So the question is, therefore, trying to anticipate what some of the trajectories of change might look like depending upon the relationship of forces in certain parts of the world, or perhaps even at a global scale as we move forward. We lay it out a kind of admittedly oversimplistic heuristic table, which has irritated several readers, and it's irritated us at times too, where we basically map out four very general ideal types of kind of the movement of politics and environment in the future. And we call them, as you've hinted at, climate Leviathan, climate behemoth, climate Mao, and climate X. And climate Leviathan, the title of the book, is the one that we expect to be most likely, and that is basically an order, either at the planetary or at the international level, that tries to maintain, to the extent that it's possible, a kind of liberal capitalist, perhaps less and less liberal, capitalist frame under the guise of very clear sovereign powers, either at the national or international scale. And we expect that to take a very heavy-handed form, precisely because the work that will be required to keep capitalism possible and to keep elites in power, to keep the dominating, that will require extraordinary exercises of sovereign power to maintain that order. But though we do think that is the most likely direction in which we're headed, and our goal is to think about how we might resist that in a just way.
What do you mean by sovereign power? And could you paint a more detailed picture of how what you're talking about, climate Leviathan, how that would differ from what we currently have as a world order?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. Request, let's say. So effectively, Joel and I have been, like a lot of us, you too, I'm sure, have been, watching the unfolding of global climate politics over the last couple of decades, especially over the last decade, and, the various meetings of the Conference of the Parties, and the most publicity, of course, being accorded to the Copenhagen meetings in 2013 and the Paris meetings in 2015. And we've been looking at the way in which, at the international level, coordinated largely by the UN and various powerful states in the global north, have been trying to address the problem of global climate change, which is, of course, as everyone knows, a global problem, but we don't at present have a global power with which to address it. And so we are trying to coordinate a collective effort on the part of various nation states. And that has, I think it's fair to say, pretty much entirely been a failure. And Joel and I are interested, therefore, in how those very same nation states may either change in terms of the exercise of power over time, or how they might alter the way in which they're organizing themselves to confront climate change, which at some point we anticipate being impossible to ignore on the part of elites and the dominant states of the global north. Now, when that comes to pass, we expect, because of the very nature of the problem, the fact that it's it's unfolding at a global level, but must be addressed at the national level. When that moment or moments occur, we expect that the most powerful states will assert a kind of power that now they only are able to exert inside their own territories. So we expect either the emergence of an attempt to, on the part of one state or perhaps a group of states, to coordinate the globe's response to climate change. And they may have to do so in a rather forceful, or even not just rather, a very forceful manner. And that's what I mean by the assertion of sovereign power, the assertion of a kind of power that we presently associate with a national government inside its own territory. But in this case, we would expect that sovereign power to expand, to sort of be arrogant enough to claim the need to save the globe in the interests of all of humanity. And we do already see those kinds of conversations, I think, emerging, and they have been emerging in the face of various expected problems like overpopulation and the ozone hole. We've had these kinds of conversations happening, and if you look back in time, we can see over and over again there's a pattern of a turn to a kind of planetary sovereign. But this is the first time that we've reached a point in the globe's ecology where we really expect that to be deemed necessary by the powers that be, in the interest of keeping those in power still in power.
I'm speaking with Jeff Mann about his co-authored book, Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future, that's published by Verso. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So keeping with the possible path of Climate Leviathan, where would you place the United States in it, given that it has exercised a role, one might say an imperial role, in coordinating and dominating beyond the limits of its border around contemporary capitalism in many ways?
The United States in particular, of course, poses some really, really interesting questions. And I say interesting in that kind of dumb way that academics use it, which is to describe as interesting what is a calamity for other people. But it is true that the status of the U.S., especially at this moment, seems to be, as you say, both imperial and extraordinarily volatile. And in fact, I was having a conversation just the other day with Joel Wainwright, you know, my co-author, and he had just been at a bookstore talking about the book. And, you know, our fundamental argument that we see, you know, climate leviathan as the most likely trajectory of global climate politics in the near future was met with some skepticism by some people in the audience, who, of course, point to Donald Trump and say, well, the U.S. is actually trying its best to be behemoth, to avoid any attempt to you know, implement a kind of planetary sovereignty, to climate deny till the cows come home, you know, to fight against precisely this process. And so far, it seems to have been very successful in doing so. So the status of the U.S. in this question is really interesting. Clearly, as you said, it has a lot of practice at imperialism, and it has proven, well, not as good as it often imagined. The U.S. state has proven, you know, to be pretty effective at imperialism. The question of how that might play out in a different realm, one in which, for example, let's say the U.S. Attempts to be one of the leading, or perhaps the leading power in a global attempt to confront catastrophic climate change, which, as we know from scientific models, is potentially not, you know, something that is that far away, that our children almost certainly will be facing. The role of the U.S. in that we imagine to be to fit much more smoothly, let's say, into the general features of the model we're proposing. We both think that the kind of approach to climate change that has taken hold amongst those in power, let's say, in the U.S. right now, not clearly amongst the majority. Many people, of course, are concerned about climate change in the U.S. But the kind of attitudes to climate change that have taken hold of the minds of those in power, we don't expect that to be a long-term situation. There will be a point, I think, not in the not-too-distant future when, as I said, the problem will be impossible to ignore. And then we anticipate the U.S. arrogating to itself a great deal of imperial right to operate at the planetary level. Perhaps one of the more obvious ways in which that might play out, and certainly one of the riskier ones, is geoengineering, for which there's no framework, of course, for deciding what is appropriate manipulation of the climate at the planetary level.
And this is using technologies like shooting pollution up into the atmosphere to try and block the sun's rays and other things to cool the planet.
Exactly right. Seeding the ocean to increase its carbon sink capacity. Atmospheric sprays to reflect some of the sun's energy back into space. In fact, that latter one, so-called solar radiation management, is by far and away the most likely, we would say, geoengineering possibility in terms of technology. And the U.S. is the leading developer of such technologies. And there's a great deal of discussion, not only in the scientific community, about tests, you know, for these kinds of programs. This is to really, truly to assert the need to make the sovereign decision to take control, you know, because something must be done and to save the planet. And that will require a great deal, not just a great deal of arrogance, but a great deal of power to ensure control over that process. And we expect, if that is to come to pass, the U.S. to play a crucial role in that process, probably along with, some other very, very important powers like China in particular.
Well, in imagining the different paths of our global future with climate change, you both examine paths that are capitalist and paths that are not. But staying with the capitalist for a bit more, how do you view the prospects of a green capitalism, a capitalism that is based on technologies that are ecologically less damaging than, say, some of the other possibilities on offer?
We don't have a great deal of faith in that route. Partly that is driven by the very simple I think reasonably straightforward argument that capitalism depends and always has on the continued expansion and growth of the system and the productivity as a whole. That requires more material throughput, whether it be solar panels or designer avocados that are organic, let's say. All of the production for production's sake is fundamental to the growth and therefore the stability of capitalism as a mode of organizing economic life. That seems to us to be, at the most straightforward level, a dead end in the face of a climate problem that cannot handle more. But even if we could imagine some dream world in which that issue was overcome and our productivity was oriented entirely in non-material or green enhancing ways, we still nonetheless confront a problem where the coordination by the state of the overall capitalist productive apparatus, which has always been essential, I might add. It is the case that there is no capitalism without the state. There never has been, and as far as we know, there never will be. And insofar as that capitalist mode of production, mode of economic life, is dependent upon a state coordinating mechanism, then that state coordinating mechanism itself poses a problem to global coordination, precisely because the state is a territorial sovereign power, just like it always has been. And it poses real institutional and political barriers to a global mechanism that has the enforceable power to coordinate carbon emissions or carbon mitigation or perhaps adaptation at a global level. So the very existence of national sovereignty, upon which capitalism absolutely depends, poses a problem to any kind of global order. Now, the overcoming of that, I think, would look a lot like what I just described earlier in the form of climate leviathan. But that is a train that will run out of track eventually.
Well, let's talk about some of the other possible paths. Tell us about the scenario that you term climate behemoth.
In some ways, it is the least well-developed of the four. And in the book, and I think with good reason, partly because it's the most simplistic. It's also the one that we anticipate being in the medium to longer term, the most, let's say, temporary, precisely because it does thus far in its manifestations. It is based largely on a sort of anti-planetary sovereign, nationalist, often reactionary form of politics that is likely to be completely unsustainable in the long run, given climate scenarios. But when we first wrote the paper upon which this book is based, which we did around 2010, we used as a sort of caricature of the climate behemoth the political power surrounding Sarah Palin and the sort of drill baby drill. There's no such thing as climate change. No one's going to tell the United States or any other country what to do. You know, this capitalist free market. We're going to mine and pump and burn coal till the cows come home, kind of thing. That was what we had in mind with Behemoth. That was a refusal, a reaction to the climate leviathan mode that we understood to be emergent in existing global climate politics, like so those meetings in Copenhagen and Paris and stuff like that. And you did see our surrounding Palin at the time, and certainly having circled their wagons around Trump right now, you know, this kind of hyper-nationalist, often very racist, reactionary politics that sees anything that smacks of international power and therefore the reduction of American sovereignty as being bad categorically. And so climate behemoth is the climate variation of that. And it has, right now it's in the White House, unfortunately. Of course, when we wrote the book, Trump was only just being elected, and we had been working on it since 2009. We never anticipated that such a ridiculous caricature of our behemoth would end up the president. but that's pretty close to what we were trying to describe.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the co-author of Climate Leviathan, a political theory of our planetary future that is published by Verso. The co-authors are Jeff Mann, my guest today, and Joel Wainwright. Jeff Mann is director of the Center for Global Political Economy at Simon Fraser University, and his other books include In the Long Run, We're All Dead, Keynesianism, Political Economy, and Revolution. So let's talk about the other possible paths in a future which is certainly going to be hotter and more chaotic than the present. And already, of course, climate change is with us. So for people who would like to see a change in the system, one sometimes hears the idea, partly a notion, partly a hope, that climate change is going to lead to a collapse of the capitalist system, and out of that, new worlds will be born. How much stock do you put in that way of seeing the future?
Like a lot of people, I probably have my days where that seems like a really workable hope. And I have, I would say, several more days where that seems really unlikely. But I do think that the challenges that climate change will pose for the ways we currently organize our lives, especially in, you know, the sort of extremely developed consumptive economies in which you and I live, I do think that climate change will pose such a significant challenge that we'll have no choice but to think hard about the kinds of alternatives that we want to arrange, because some alternative will be absolutely necessary. We can't keep going as things are. So I do think that there's hope. Sometimes I feel like I say that just because I don't want to have no hope. And sometimes I say that because I really do have hope. But I also would always want to flag the fact that those non-capitalist or alternative modes of organization that will be necessary and possible in a not too distant future are not all equally desirable, and some of them are downright terrifying and would make what we have look like a paradise. So I think the task for climate justice politics right now is to think about how to manage what will be a necessary transition or change.
Well, let's talk about the possibility of a way of organizing society outside of the framework of capitalism. Tell us about what you call climate Mao.
Sure. So climate Mao, Joel and I locate to the extent that we think it's possible. And actually, I do think it is more and more possible, I would say. We imagine that one of the ways in which human societies and the existing nation states might deal with climate change as it becomes more and more of an evident emergency for the majority of people would be to react against markets and the proliferation of the capitalist mode of organizing things, and to think hard about a revolutionary alternative like those that have come to pass in the past. And the one that we had in mind in particular, of course, is the Maoist revolution in China, and to think about in particular the power of China right now, its revolutionary history, and the political context in which it's situated, meaning an Asia that is particularly stressed by climate change and is likely to be even more so in the past, and to think about the conjuncture of those things, a revolutionary tradition of a very particular kind, let's say, in the Maoist tradition, hundreds of millions of people, potentially a huge proportion of whom will be incredibly stressed by the kinds of processes that climate change is going to unleash, and to look at an alternative mode of organizing in the face of that change would be to see a rejuvenation of the Maoist tradition. That's not to say right now that China is some Mao figure. China is, of course, a very complicated variation on capitalism, one might even argue right now. But it does have the political capacity and the political institutions, political economic institutions, that are built on a legacy, of a Maoist model. And in fact, the sort of president for lifing of Xi right now is arguably it might facilitate this in an even better way. And so we are expecting, in particular, countries that perhaps already have a revolutionary tradition of mass organizing, especially amongst peasants, to react to climate change in a way very different than we would, say, in Canada, the United States, and to turn to a very heavy-handed variation of a kind of communist model that is extremely state-based, of course. And what's interesting is that to refer to this paper from 2000 that we wrote when we were first starting thinking about this book, we presented this in lots of different places and spoke to students and folks at meetings all over the place. And what was interesting is that, especially since a large proportion of our audience were self-identified lefties, that very often what we called Climate Mao, which was less developed then, but very often what we called Climate Mao was by far and away the most attractive option to many people in the audience. It was really interesting. And partly that was driven by the sense of emergency. The Chinese state has already demonstrated several times around the Olympics, let's say, and stuff like that, that it has the capacity to get things done very quickly at a scale that is unimaginable in a functioning representative democracy. And so the very idea of a revolutionary state that has the capacity and power to respond to the emergency of climate change was very attractive to many people who saw it as really the only way out. Because as you and I will probably talk about in a few minutes, this more democratic model that we call Climate X definitely doesn't have that kind of responsiveness. And so it was a very interesting reaction, one that surprised us, to be honest with you. People were like, yeah, Climate Mao now, please.
Tell us about the fourth scenario that you and Joel Wainwright picture, which you call Climate X.
Right. So this is the one, these are ideal types. It's a heuristic, and we're very aware of the limits of the model. And so I just want to preface this with that reminder. But so this is the one we're hoping for, obviously. This is what we see as a non or an anti-planetary sovereign or even anti-sovereignty and anti-capitalist trajectory that would address not only the facts of climate change and hopefully to subdue it to some extent, but certainly to to think hard about how we live in a climate-changed world, but to do so in a just way, in a democratic way. And so, as I said, the way the boxes are structured in the model, this is the one that falls in the anti-sovereignty, anti-capitalist box. And insofar as that's the case, we really do imagine this being about a wide variety, not necessarily one movement, but a wide variety of movements struggling for democratic and just modes and means of dealing with a changing world in their communities where they live, coordinating what we would now think of as internationally or across communities in efforts to ensure as much as possible, equal access to a dignified life for people whose lives are going to be put at risk most likely very quickly in the face of climate change. Because as we know, the implications, the ecological and political implications of climate change are most immediate and most terrifying for those who are already the poorest and most marginalized in the planet. So we have to think about those of us in the privileged part of the world articulating with and in supporting the not only the capacity of those communities to adapt, but to as much as possible about helping those communities and our own, if it's possible, to flourish, to actually, as you said earlier, to take advantage of the shift to produce a more just world. And so we call it X largely because we think that it's going to take a million different forms, and we're going to learn from a million different sources, and it's going to be very context specific. But one of the things it will not be is coordinated by a planetary sovereign. And one of the things it will not be is oriented around production for production's sake.
So anti-capitalist, as you say, Not oriented around production for production's sake, but also anti-state or a different kind of vision of the state?
Yes, I think so, actually. And then I have to say, this is my own thought. I mean, all of this is, of course, my own thought, but I should say, some of the things that I'm now saying are things I haven't had a chance to talk over with Joel, whereas much of what I'm saying is, of course, a product of us thinking together. And one might even say that I've learned a lot more from him than he's learned from me. I would say that one of the things that I think that our political situation right now suggests, both at an ecological level, but also in terms of the trajectory of current, say, quasi-fascisms or the emergent wannabe totalitarianisms that seem to be crystallizing in certain places, including Washington, those forces, I would suggest, should make us think very hard about, if not anti-state politics, certainly about a radical decentralization and localization of democratic decision making, if only because the kinds of impunity and devastating political actions that are unfolding right now at the national scale in several places would suggest to us that we need to keep power at the local level. We need to decentralize. And I think that climate change is a perfect example of how we have to confront this, precisely because of the virtually complete failure to do so at the national and international scale. I think that instead of continually hoping for the emergence of some Leviathan at the next conference of the parties meeting, we need to be thinking about, in fact, opposing the attempt to kind of keep business as usual, somehow it'll be green and everything else will be the same. I think we need to fight that against that and to actually argue for the decentralization of the power to confront climate change. We'll do this at the local level if it's ever going to happen. And I think actually we already see this happening at cities all around the world who are saying, well, my state is a total failure. It's actually making climate change worse. So that at the local level, urban governments are trying to make these shifts happen. Those sorts of things are the things we need to really focus on, cultivate, nurture. The next meeting in whatever big city in whatever part of Western Europe shouldn't be our concern.
I'm speaking with Jeff Mann. He is the co-author of Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, in thinking about the different paths that our future could take, and thinking about the more desirable paths, which you're arguing for come from below, that are anti-capitalist, in thinking about how how movements form. I wanted to ask you if you, since you write a lot about, and as a, someone grappling with political theory, about states of emergency and what happens in these moments of emergency, how does fear affect both the emergence of political movements and the kind of characteristics they take on?
Yeah, fascinating question. Obviously very important at this moment. It's, I suppose, something of a of an attempt to duck the question if I were to say something like, you know, it can be many things. It can be a motivator. It can be a paralyzer, these kinds of things. Even though I think, even though they're sort of platitudes, I think that those both those statements are sort of true. But I also think that at this moment, one of the sort of, I think, key organizing goals at a grand scale, of course, because it has to be just part of a whole series of other political efforts, is to do our best to confront fear explicitly. In other words, to not make it not a part of the conversation, to not suppress it or pretend it's not part of what's going on. I think one of the ways that we have the best chance of overcoming one of the places fear can take us, which is, of course, to vilify other people, particularly someone who might perhaps have to migrate into the United States or Canada, for example, you know, to turn inward in this nationalist, anti-immigrant manner that we're seeing all over the place in various kinds of challenges. I think that one of the things we have to confront is to talk about fear, to make it a conversation piece that we can admit to, that we can confront, and that we can, as much as possible, subdue by looking it straight in the face and asking ourselves what it's making us do and what we might otherwise wish to be doing. So instead of allowing fear to be the organizer, it's more like we have to organize in the face of fear, not saying that we're brave and there's nothing to fear and this kind of stuff, this sort of Churchillian approaches to, you know, something like the Second World War, but more like we are in trouble. Let's think for a moment about the kinds of ways that we need to react to face up to this problem, while at the same time comforting ourselves in the fact that we are afraid, and that so are the people who are moving here, so are the other nations in the world. We have to make it as explicit as possible. I think this is true, actually, not just of fear, but of a sort of tragic sensibility that seems to me to be saturating modern life, where there is a feeling that we live in something like end times. Now, I really hope, and I actually, on the good days, honestly believe that's not true. But I do think that if we allow that to grow even bigger and to dominate more and more our understanding of the future, and especially in the way that we raise our children and understand the long-term trajectories of our lives and the institutions that depend on them, I think that would be a disaster. So my goal right now actually is to talk precisely about these things, to think about what it means to live in fear, what it means to understand one moment in history as a tragedy. Because we still need to answer those everyday questions of love and security and dignity and getting by and looking each other in the face and caring. And that doesn't go away in a moment that is saturated by fear and that tragic sensibility. I apologize for the vagueness of these feelings, but you've hit a nerve for sure.
Not at all. I mean, that fatalism definitely infuses a lot of the writings on the left. And you note in the book that in many of the writings on climate, the conclusion, and using this a modified version of this term that's acceptable with the FCC, it's we're effed. And yet, of course, there's all sorts of implications of fatalism for thinking about different possible paths, and that there's not just one path. And I think that's connected to another point you make in the book, which is that it's in thinking about the future on a hotter planet, it's easy to lapse into a kind of environmental determinism that what happens ecologically is going to shape in a very narrow way what happens politically. But you are arguing that, in fact, is not necessarily the case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You've said it exactly as I would like to have said it, and probably much more articulately.
And then connected to that, let me ask you about how we should try to infuse a kind of politics into something which often is seen as being within the arena of science. We look to scientists to tell us whether we've passed a tipping point, the point of no return. What are the limits of thinking about this issue through only through a scientific lens? Obviously, that also needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. Certainly, science is absolutely essential to any attempt to think about how we might confront climate change. It's certainly, to state the obvious, it's been essential to understand the very problem itself. And in fact, precisely because of its sort of slow staccato of what seemed like increasingly rapid crises, but previously were perhaps harder to see, science has been essential to even identifying it as something that we need to think about. So the role of science has been and will continue to be essential. That said, as we say in the book, and as many people have said in lots of other books, science is inescapably social. The problems to which it turns, the questions it imagines itself able to answer, and the power that's associated with the knowledge and in whose hands that knowledge is held are always a product, a direct product of the political, economic, and social organization of the communities in which that knowledge emerges and circulates. And so science is always an attempt, I think, to understand the world in something like an objective fashion, but it can never be objective beyond that moment, in the sense that that knowledge held by people is always, as everyone knows, I suppose, power. To know is to have power to some extent. And if that's the case, then as soon as we do have this knowledge, how it's mobilized, who it's used by, and the kinds of questions to which it's turned are, of course, the crucial political questions that the rest of us can have a lot of say in, even if we're not scientists. So all of this to say that science is crucial, but it can't be the answer. It can be part of our response, but it can't be the answer. And in fact, I think our current situation would be proof that it can't be the answer, because clearly just, you know, the increasing pile of knowledge that we are effed, as you say, is not motivating or producing the kind of response we need. So the answers are not in science, though science, of course, must be part of the answer.
Well, speaking about knowledge, let me end by asking you a question about theory. And I think you would agree that this is not simply an academic question. So the subtitle of your book, Climate Leviathan, is a political theory of our planetary future. And you argue that the body of, or most of the body of existing political theory is just not up to the task of imagining the world in a climate-changed future. And partly that's because political theory assumes that societies will stay stable, but the future looks like it's going to be unstable. Why do you think it is important that we grapple with theory here, that we are able to seize on the right kind of analysis as a tool for social movements and social change?
That's a super interesting question. Clearly, Joel and I struggle, like many, many, many other people, to think about the articulation between, you know, the kind of work we do in the academy, which is often, as you know, and this book falls victim to this certainly at many points, which is, you know, aimed to a very kind of specialized audience with a particular kind of training and comfort level with a certain, you know, not just a certain discourse, but even a certain jargon and a whole history of, you know, in this case, political thought, but it could be any other kind of thought. If I was an engineer, it's not like it would be that much clearer to the vast majority of people. So we struggle with how to, you know, make sense of that. And in fact, struggle with how to not only make sense of that, but how to feel good about that in a world that sometimes seems like we are fiddling while Rome burns, because here we are doing political theory while wildfires eat up California, for example. It's a constant worry, and perhaps it's part of what drives our research to these questions that we think of as being important socially, so we can connect them. But I would also say, and this is going to sound defensive because here I've co-written a book on political theory, that even people who think of themselves as anti-theoretical or really empirically focused or empiricist even, even people who imagine that their confrontation with the world on a daily basis in an attempt to make sense of it, to change it, to even merely to just adapt to it, those people are all relying absolutely irreducibly on extremely complicated theories of how the world works, whether they know it or not. And I know that sounds kind of arrogant to say, but it's always true that it's, or at least I would say it's always true that our confrontation with the world and our attempts to make sense of it are always filtered by the categories we've learned to put things in and to make sense of movement and change or the lack thereof. And insofar as those categories map our world for us, every moment we're in facing it, every moment we're in the middle of it, every moment we're looking at it, those categories are the elements that make up a theory of the world. They are the reason you expect certain things to happen when you do certain things, or not to happen when you don't do certain things. And so that means that if that's true, that theory always mediates everything we do in the world, then with something as important as climate change or the political organization of our lives, we should be really effing careful to be as clear and as critical in that thinking of our theory as we can, to put it right on the table, to be explicit about it, to talk about the categories we're using, what's in them, what's out of them, have they changed, have they not. We have to really burn in on those with our eyes and our hands and our brains to understand our experience of the world and where it might take us. So Joel and I think, would defend the work of theory as being absolutely essential, if of course never enough on its own, but absolutely essential to every single political endeavor. And so here we have taken what you know is a rather academic first stab at this, but we're hoping to connect with people who aren't just academics, who are just as concerned about the categories and processes through which we try to make sense of our world and how we might use those or change them so that we can have a better world, or at least one that persists, you know, in which our children can live safe, dignified, and joyful lives.
Jeff Mann, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a real honor to get to talk to you.
I've been speaking with the director of the Center for Global Political Economy at Simon Fraser University, co-author of Climate Leviathan, A Political Theory of Our Planetary Future. You can find a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org. Joel Wainwright is the other author. And Jeff Mann's other books include In the Long Run, We're All Dead. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.